Hello and welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Tom Senior.
Hello.
And Tom Francis.
Hello.
Toms, why is it so goddamn cold?
Due to weather, I believe.
Okay, it's weather. Tom?
I believe also it is the weather.
Okay, that...
It's actually snowing today, isn't it?
It is snowing.
Trying to snow.
It was earlier.
It's bullshit. That's all I'm going to say about that.
I like it. It's going to be cold. It should snow a little bit. It's like your reward for it being cold. Or compensation.
It's March. Like, it's going to be April soon. I'm done with this.
It snows in March sometimes. It's when it gets into late April and it's still snowing that we need to go and find the ice wizard and kill him in order to stop this from happening anymore.
That's what I assumed was going on, but now apparently it's weather.
Yep. Sorry, man.
Damn it. I always want a solution. Tom Francis,
You
have played and finished and reviewed Bioshock Infinite.
We
are recording this on the Monday, so about 12 hours now, or like less than that now, before it unlocks. So the rest of us haven't played it. And so if you're wondering whether we're going to talk about it on the podcast, and I know we have loads of questions about it, we are not going to talk about it on this podcast. We're going to do a special like we do with Dishonored later on, like in a week or something, when more of us have had a chance to finish it.
But our Dishonored podcast ended up being kind of the Dishonored plot problem podcast.
Yeah, and from the sounds of your review, we may also have something similar to go with.
That'll be interesting.
With Bioshock Infinite. But that it maybe explains the remit of the rest of this podcast as we avoid the elephant in the room, which is that game, because apparently it's very good. But
it's very good. It's 91% game.
It's 91% games.
So exciting.
So exciting. But, Tom, you have otherwise been playing Starforge.
Yes. So that's it's one of the early access things on Steam, and it's a game that... It's one of those things, like, you see a tech demo for on YouTube and looks way too good to be true, and you think that's never coming out, or it'll be incredible if it ever does come out. And now it's on Steam as in the new early access thing where you pay... It's basically paid alphas on Steam. And there's only like sort of 8 games that are doing that now. But you can play it and it's real. And it's completely insane. So it's a futuristic kind of... Right now the only two modes are sandbox and survival. And survival is like sort of co-op, last stand type thing where you're protecting a big vat of stuff from aliens. But the crazy thing about it is it's got Minecraft's like block placing ability. So you can just plant down blocks. But it's all very high fidelity. It looks like a kind of AAA shooter. And when you place a block, a concrete block or something, a single cube will kind of have like steel girders all around it and kind of spikes and stuff. And then if you place another one next to it, all the textures and models adapt to kind of make it look like a contiguous wall. So it's not like... not all blocks are the same. They change shape and look to make the overall thing you're building look good. And there's seen videos where like the guy gets batted by a giant spinning girder that just bats him into space like, through the atmosphere. There are loads of shots of going way up into the point where you can kind of see the curvature of the planet. So it seems like total ridiculous fantasy game like Minecraft, but infinite and high fidelity and amazing in every way. And it's got like physical animation, sort of a combination of animation and physics. So as you're running along, you can be like tripped over and your body can get caught on things and stuff. And most of that is kind of true. You don't seem to be able to go to space as far as I could tell. Like even in sandbox mode, I tried placing blocks beneath my feet. And that stuff does work really well. Like it does look good when you place a block and it kind of forms a organic part of the wall that you're making. But then I'm just like doing what I do in Minecraft, just jump up, place a block beneath my feet, jump up again, place another block, kept doing that. And then I seemed to hit some kind of limit and I could see a huge spectacular view of all these rolling hills of the world I was on, but I couldn't seem to go actually into space. And then I just jumped off and my guy screamed as he fell to his death. But yeah, the sandbox mode, it's when you sort of try and play it as a game that it doesn't really hold up. And you're defending this vat against some like waves of like sandworms, and they're huge, but they're really sort of wonkily animated and they just kind of shuffle around. And it's all about, there are some turrets you can place, but they're pretty boring. And the more exotic stuff is like you place these big spinning girdery type things. So you can place one that's like spinning vertically, and these are huge. They're like size of a small building.
Like wind turbine kind of things.
Yeah. Or you can place one that's spinning on the ground, to kind of like, so there's a disc of damage that where it can hit. Or you can place one that just spins on its own axis, so it's just this cylinder that just rotates, and it doesn't really hurt if you touch it. And the description for that one just says, no one knows why this exists. I think they just figured out
that. Do you attach them to each other, so you can, like, a spinny thing attached to a different spinning thing?
They're quite... it's quite difficult to place them at all. They're kind of like, it's, you know, it hovers in front of you as you move your view around and tries to predict where you want it to go, but then it's really hard to, like, place it on top of something. Or I kept trying to place my missile turret on top of the vat that I was protecting, but I couldn't get above the vat to kind of look down on it and see the ground that I wanted to place it on. So I was, like, jumping on top of a crate and then trying to slap it down midair, and then it would fall off the vat and tumble down, and then, like, fire missiles as it fell down. And when those big spinning girders hit the sandworms, like, the physics just doesn't happen. Like, it just, they kind of just go through it, or they bump up on top of it, and there's no kind of, like, sense of impact or anything. And they might be doing damage. I guess they probably are, but it's hard to tell whether anything's working at all. And really, it's better just to shoot them with your infinite ammo machine gun.
So it's, I mean, it's definitely alpha.
Yeah, I would say don't buy it yet.
Yeah. How much does that cost?
If this was a free demo, I think it's like 15 quid.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 20.
And presumably you get access for life then.
Yeah. As they make it into a full-fledged thing. But it's, I don't know, it seems just as unlikely that they'll make it into a fully-fledged, perfectly working game as it does when you see the tech demos on YouTube. You know, it goes from being, oh, this is too good to be true, to being, oh, this is nowhere near what I want it to be.
That's a shame.
They might complete it, but yeah, I would say don't buy it yet.
Yeah, I still don't know what I make about early access as a service. So it's going to happen anyway, and technically I don't really have a problem with it being in Steam, apart from the fact that it makes it more acceptable to do in broad terms.
Yeah. I think it's... I used to be really cynical about it and think it was like, oh, developers just found this, like, magic word they can put in their name of their game, and then they can release a broken thing and charge us money for it, and no one can call them out on it. But now I kind of think, well, you know, that word does actually mean something. People know that when you say alpha or when you say early access, they know they're getting a bugged thing. Mm. And so it's not unfair to charge money for it, even if it's slightly... I'm still not totally sure about charging an amount of money that even you don't think the game in its current state is worth. Because I know that people are getting the thing in the future, but it's like combination pre-order and getting a thing that isn't really worth the money you spent. And I kind of... when I think about... my own game, what I want to charge for that, I always think, like, anytime I'm going to ask money of a gamer, I want it to be something I would be willing to pay for what I'm giving them right now, because you don't know what you're going to do in the future. You hope you're going to improve it, you hope you're going to make it worth that amount of money, but you might not, you might fuck up, you might die. That could happen.
Yeah, like, I mean I think it's fair as well that people don't often put money down. I mean, even pre-orders, you know, bear in mind, there are paid pre-orders and there are pre-orders which are just sort of, you can cancel at any point. They're essentially registering just to make it. When you're actually exchanging money, the point where you exchange the money should be the point where you can immediately benefit fully
from
the money you've exchanged.
And that's, I think that's one of the things that makes me uneasy about these DLC season passes, where you're paying 20 quid for a bunch of DLC that they haven't even started making yet in some cases, or, you know, you don't even know what it is. They haven't even announced what form this is going to take. And when that stuff doesn't, like, you lose your money right then and there. So if it doesn't turn out to be worth it, you get no...
Do you think so with Kickstarter, do you think the tiers kind of negate that problem? The fact that you can pay a lesser sum or a more...
I think I always see Kickstarter as a charity. I know that sounds like... I don't mean that in a disparaging way. Like, it's generally for things that where you are so passionate about this thing that you will give money to support the people who are trying to make it, and you understand it might not happen. And, you know, like the alpha tag, when something's called an alpha, you know it's going to have bugs. When something's called a Kickstarter, you know it might never see the light of day.
Fair enough.
And so I follow that in terms of what I back. I see loads and loads of exciting things on Kickstarter, but I've only backed like 3 projects because they're the ones where I really like the people who are doing it, want to support them, and want them to have the best chance of doing it. I believe they need the money to do it, which is a common one Kickstarter's fail. And I also want the rewards and think I will get them.
Fair enough.
So, speaking of... actually, it's a segue that's never going to work. You've also been playing Spoon Commander Forge Delight. So it's going to be like a really convoluted gas-powered games sort of like Kickstarter segue thing, but it got out of hand before I'd even started saying it, so...
yes. I've actually been playing a thing called Forge Alliance Forever, which is a mod for Forge Alliance, and it exists because... the only way to play Forge of Alliance online was before it came to Steam late last year, I think it was. You had to go through GPG.net, which is a matchmaking service that Gaspar had made.
Yeah, those things are never a bad idea.
Yeah, it was a bad idea even at the time. But in particular, like, it was sort of all controlled by THQ. Like, if they wanted to update the game, it had to be approved by THQ. And it ended in a really awkward way where they made a new patch that fixed a lot of serious balancing issues, and then THQ never approved it. Like, they just sort of, their budget ran out, or their ability to care about this game ran out. And so there's this patch waiting to go live, and the community's played it in beta form, and it works, and they like it, and all the changes they agree with. But it can't be, it's not on GasparGames.net because THQ never approved it, so it's not official. And that means half the community's playing the balanced version, and then the other half are playing the latest official version, because that means they can use the network, the matchmaking thing. And of course, like, the, you know, never got updated again after that. So Forge Alliance Forever was a thing that, like, I'd heard about it and I didn't really bother with it because I kind of assumed it couldn't possibly work because it's supposed to patch the game to the latest, you know, that good patch that Gaspar Games made. Take it a bit further than that and patch it with community suggestions and other things that they found in balance since then. Make it completely replace Gaspar's own networking thing with their own matchmaking system that also incorporates true skill and, you know, proper matchmaking, which GPG.net actually didn't have. It was just a sort of way of finding games. It didn't actually match you with people of the same skill level. Integrate like an online map vault where you can download all community maps. You can watch replays of games that are happening right now. Like, you can just jump into a game and watch the game up until that point in fast motion, if you like, or in real time. And then when it gets to the point that they're currently playing, carry on watching it live.
What?
And like, that can't work. It does. It works perfectly. Wow. Completely seamless. You can just look at a list of like, oh, look, like 25. That's the other thing, is like loads of people are playing it all the time. Like 25 people are playing, 25 different games are going on right now. You know, like, this one's like a 12 player epic match on an 81 kilometer map. And I just double click on it, and they're like 15 minutes in. So I fast forward through those 15 minutes and watch all these like massive wars going on. Then I get up to live spectating and watching like pro players have this incredible, spectacular war.
That's crazy. Who's responsible for this? Who did this?
The community, that shadow entity. Amazing games. So it's a
Jesus.
It's really interesting. One of the games I watched was between. I don't think this was live. I think this was in the Replay Vault, because it also stores all these games in a massive archive. So if you hear. I was reading like the forums where they're discussing balance changes, and so they launch a patch and then they talk about, you know, is this working? Should we change this? Should we make Monkey Lord more expensive or whatever? And then they work those changes into a beta and then have the community kind of test that. That's the other thing, is you can switch seamlessly between their community patch, the last official gas-powered one, and also like 12 different mods. And it never replaces your installs. You never have to uninstall anything. You just double-click whichever version you want to play right now, and it will seamlessly launch into that. And it doesn't matter which of those things that any of these replays were played in. Like, if they're played using these really obscure mods, it will automatically download and load those. If you don't have the map, it will seamlessly load in the map before you join. It's just incredible. It just works.
Good job, the community.
Yeah, whoever the hell you are. Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is I was reading the forum where they discussed balance changes, and I saw it looked like... There was heated disagreements, as there always are. I kept seeing the same names come up, and one guy was saying, like, this player had opposed his suggestion, and he was saying, oh, man, I thought you'd agree with this, because I saw your game and on that map last week, and you got totally owned by this thing, so I thought you'd want it nerfed. And so I was able to, like, type that guy's name into the Replay Vault and find the game he's talking about and then watch it happen. And as they're playing, because he's obviously one of the guys who helps do the patches and, you know, one of the shadowy community... that game actually turned out to be a balance testing game where they were, as they were playing, they're discussing, okay, I'm doing this to you now. Is this overpowered? Does it help when I do this? But so you can, like, it's really weird. It's because you'd never get that with a developer. Like, you'd never sort of join a Blizzard game and watch Blizzard people discussing StarCraft balance and saying, yeah, Baelings are just bullshit right now. We're totally screwing this up.
Yeah. It's funny, though, because, I mean, without jumping the gun, like, I've been playing Heart of the Swarm. It's kind of... what I was consuming most of my time recently, and I've been really impressed with the way they've kind of rethought game replays and things. It's interesting to hear a different angle on the same thing.
Like, yeah.
Have you played with the Heart of the Swarm?
I haven't played with it yet, but I was bitching to Rich that I was watching all these MLG matches and they kept crashing out and there's all networking problems, and they seem to be really common to have networking problems at professional StarCraft tournaments. But Rich was saying now that they can, even if a player gets dropped, they can load the replay in and then
yeah.
go up to where they were.
They so now have like a resume button on lost yeah. matches. But it means you can also load any replay you've ever had and jump in as any of the players at any point in the match.
Hmm.
Like, and you even get it, like I was playing 3v3s last night with myself, Rich, and Martin Gaston from GameSpot. And we were, after each match, you get a kind of like load replay as party. And all three of you load the replay at once. And then the three of you can like, we could say like, could we have beaten ourselves from this point? If you like, jump into the other team and try and beat, and then the AI will just take over from for you based on what you had at that moment.
Right.
Kind of awesome. Like, seems like really good replay features are how you balance a game quickly, you know, or how you kind of give people the tools to really, really pick apart mechanics. Yeah. That's really kind of cool. But I love the idea of being able to fast forward through a game, a live game, to that point.
Yeah. Like, you can't do that in StarCraft, I take it.
No. You can jump into, you can't, I don't think you can jump in live games at all in StarCraft unless they're part of the tournament.
Right.
I might be wrong about that. You can jump into any live Dota, any Dota game that's happening on the public servers and watch it, but you just go in at that point and you don't get you don't see what happened previously.
I like it with SupCon because I love playing SupCon myself, but I don't really want to play against people online because I'm no good. Like, it's when you play it at the really high levels, it's a fucking like brain melting nightmare. It's just, you must be clicking on every single thing in the universe at all times and managing like, you know, every mass extractor on the map. And so I can never play at that pro level, and I don't really want to. Like, I don't think I'd enjoy it, really. I don't like it when it's super stressful and super time-sensitive. So it's good to be able to watch pros do it and see. Mm. There's just an amazing thing in the game I was talking about earlier where they're playing 4v4 on Seton's Clutch. So it's this long diagonal peninsula with connecting two land masses, which probably means it's not technically a peninsula.
Isn't it just a land bridge?
Yeah, I guess so. And it was clear the bottom side were going to lose. Like, they lost two of their players early on. So it's assassination mode. So if you lose your commander, you're out of the game. But other than the things it kills when it blows up with its nuclear explosion, all of your units stay in the game and they get given to another player. So when one player's out, it's not totally like, oh shit, now we're, you know, only three quarters of a team, so we're definitely going to lose, because most of his stuff gets inherited by one of his teammates. Mm. But one of the... one of the better players. I actually instantly had a favorite player in this match. I could just see he was doing everything right. Like, I love the way he was controlling the C's in the bottom right. Every time he was involved in any clash, he kind of did what I think he should do. And then he was, there was still one commander left, and it was, actually there was two, but the one that was directly opposite his patch of water that he was trying to keep control of was still alive. And, he'd specialized in like naval and air, so he'd got like huge swarms of air superiority fighters, and they just go around this massive like black cloud just blotting out the sun. And then he started building strategic bombers, and the guy had really good anti-air, so the strategic bombers were going to get shot down if they just went straight there. So he like took away all of his engineers who were assisting anything and had them all assist just one air factory, and then built the cheapest air unit in the game, which is a Tech 1 Air Scout. And with all of those engineers assisting it, all of his economy, he could build them in basically a steady, solid stream from the factory. And so you zoom out on the map, and there's just this solid line from his air factory to the enemy base, just of fighters being endlessly shot down by amazing air defense. And it just keeps them distracted. So, at, you know, at any given time, an anti-air SAM site has just fired its missiles at one of those fucking scouts that's on it. So when the bombers arrive, like half of the anti-air turrets are all unable to fire right then. And then they get distracted by all the, you know, endless planes going into their base. And it's awesome because it's like, it's a distraction technique, but you don't even need to time it because you can just afford to constantly produce distractions at all times. It's like basically chaff.
It would really suck to be one of those pilots.
Yeah, luckily they're all drones.
Okay. That's all right then.
It's like poking your enemy with a massive metal sky stick. Yeah. Constantly. Just going, yeah, no, look at the stick. Look at the stick. Look at the stick made of
them.
Stealth jets. Yeah.
Man, that's awesome. Yeah, I think I used to play quite a bit of Supreme Commander with friends, but it's never been the strategy game that I've clicked. It's never clicked with me, I think. And I think it's possibly because it's so... I don't know, I want to use the word loose, but I don't want to use it in a kind of in a derogatory way. Like, it's mechanically, like, StarCraft is super, super slick, right? Like, and everything, it's so well sort of honed at the edges, apart from when it's got little balance problems or whatever. But there's, I guess, less room for kind of crazy.
There's loads of units in Supreme Commander that are just better than other units. It's like, this one's just a better version of that. It does everything out there.
Like, but tier one better. Tank is better than tier one tank kind of thing, or is that?
What I was talking about was basically that there's tech one and tech two and tech three, and the new tech three thing is just better than a tech one thing. It doesn't have any disadvantages versus that. But there are a few units that kind of, it's a matter of debate in the community, but one of the things that big patch fix that Gas Power Games were trying to make live just before THQ stopped supporting it was that the factional differences are all quite small. They're all quite subtle. Like, they mostly have roughly the same units, and then each one will have like a gap at a certain tech level, or they'll have an extra unit at a certain tech level. And the Aeon have their gunship, which is usually an air-to-ground unit, also has anti-air. And for ages, it was brilliant in anti-air, and it was also brilliant anti-ground. And it just had no drawbacks. It was just the unit that was just good against everything all the time. And if you just build that, the only thing that can defeat it is just more of that.
Yeah.
And so they made that more expensive and slightly less effective. But it's still kind of, there are still units like that where there's still no drawback to that unit. It's just slightly less efficient if you're being exactly countered.
Terry, do you reckon you will ever kind of stop? Like, is it just, I guess, for you from playing it like against AI, is it just an experimenting thing now, or is it something you're actually kind of building towards? Taking online, or is it no interest? I know you don't like competing online, but
I don't try and get any better at it. Like, when I play, it's just I have this experience I really enjoy of beating AIs, and I do that, and I want it to be as hard as it can be without me losing. So yeah. I always want to win. I just want to like feel like I might lose at some point, but then ultimately win. And so the thing that gets me excited about it is always just thinking up new strategies. Like, I'll just suddenly think, oh my God, what if I just had like massive tech three land army and then tried to control the seas to the left and, you know, did this with my economy. And because it has this huge, huge menu of units. So like, there's just so many to think about, so many different options. And they are also really cool. It has this like physicality to it that I never got from StarCraft, where like everything is simulated and, you know, every shot is individually tracked. And if it hits a mountain before it hits the enemy, then it doesn't hurt the enemy. And everything blows up with this really kind of satisfying force, and everything leaves a wreck when it's dead. And the sound design is just perfect. It makes everything feel really solid and powerful and real. And it's basically just a constant stream of explosions, some of which are still staggeringly cool to look at. Even like, it was recent 2007, so I guess we're 6 years on now, and it's still beautiful. When I play on my own, it's always just about thinking up a cool strategy, trying to execute it, sometimes encountering difficulties in doing that, but then when it works, just finding it incredibly satisfying.
Awesome. Cool. We'll play that now. Yeah. We'll play that.
Yeah, good work, 2007.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So will you ever go back to Supreme Commander 2?
I did, because they released a patch, like just recently, which is weird. And they had to, like in their press release to us, it was just an email actually. They had to say, you know, please don't read anything into the timing of this, like, because Gas Powered have just been bought by Wargaming.net, and everyone's wondering what the next project is. Apparently their next project is a free-to-play MMO, but the patch for Supreme Commander 2 is quite major. I haven't had a chance to like really get into it yet, but the biggest thing is that mass extractors gain veterancy. Which, believe me, that's big news if you know what all those words mean. Because
individually, but as part of a sentence.
In the context of Supreme Commander 2.
So the thing is that mine stuff can get better at mining stuff through experience.
So it's like if all your drones in StarCraft 2 just started mining more and more minerals the longer they survived. And that would be crazy.
I see. So it means that like killing someone's veteran mass extractors is a bigger deal than it would have been. Yeah, okay.
And I thought, this was something I think I might have even had this idea and thought they should do this, because in Supreme Commander 1, you manually upgrade mass extractors, and it's a big investment, takes a long time, and can completely cripple your economy if you do it at the wrong time. You try and upgrade too many at once, or like you see, oh, you're getting loads and loads of mass and loads of energy, I should spend this to upgrade my economy. And then as soon as you start it, you realize that there's something else that you were just starting to build that's only just kicked in, or one of your engineers finally reaches the place that it was going to build a turret, and then that drains your economy, and then all of it crashes. And it's really cruel. Like, you can't even pause the upgrading. You can, but it still drains some resources. So it's still crippling your economy even when you say, no, sorry, I didn't mean to upgrade that thing. So it's brutally punishing and really complicated to manage. Supreme Commander 2 just said, no, you can't upgrade mass extractors at all ever. There are some passive bonuses you can get to resources in the research menu by just spending points on a thing, but you can never like crash your economy, and you don't have to think about what to upgrade. And it did mean that it was just like totally flat. It was just, you know, all mass extractors are equal. So all parts of the map that have them are kind of equally strategically important. And so you get less kind of less attached to particular outposts or whatever. You wouldn't think like, oh, God, that's my really, really important outpost, because it's just the same as all the others. And so in theory, the idea that mass extractors just passively getting better all the time, as long as you hold on to them, as long as you don't keep losing them to skirmishes, should mean that you kind of get really paranoid about defense and maybe stick to fewer bases but make them really well defended. And that seemed like a good idea. But when I played it, as soon as I, like, when you hear a theory and you try to imagine how it's going to play, it's totally different to when you actually start a game and start playing. And I look at the battlefield and see all these mass extractors and think, shit, I should take all of them at once. Just send one engineer to every single one on the map. Because it, like, all the time that you own one, you're getting a free upgrade all the time, because this doesn't cost you anything. That's a big difference between this and Spring Runner 1. It used to be a big investment of your resources, and now it's just free. Just everything's getting better all the time. So the more you own, the more free stuff you're getting all the time. And if you can defend some of them, then they'll be great. And you don't really know in advance which ones you can defend. And it's easier to have, like, I guess I'm only playing against the AI, so I don't really know how it plays out in competitive matches, but it was easier for me to defend everything a little bit than it was to defend one thing completely. Like, if they really come for you, then they can take anything they like. But if you can just defend against that one lone engineer or just that small squadron of tanks that they send out, just kind of scout, then you're fine. And so I just took everything. And it didn't. It kind of had the opposite effect, basically. It made me spread out more, defend less.
I just like the idea of a frontline mass extractor, which is like scarred. It's got, it's got like, I've seen some things.
Because they're not, you know, in StarCraft, they are actually worker units, like even if they're robots or whatever, they're actually things, right? Whereas the mass extractor is, it's more like an oil pump. Like, it is just a tool. Like, it's like a drill
I've
getting
really
better.
I've learned a lot about drilling.
Yeah, exactly. Up and down and up and down. And like, the first thing you need to know in mass extractor school is extract mass.
Forget it. I can't teach you, son. You just got to go out there and do it for yourself.
I've mined some minerals, man. Yeah. I've mined more minerals than you could believe.
Seriously,
I've seen some ore in my life.
Ore never changes.
That was good.
Which a process of extraction does.
Yeah. I like. Also, how does that veterancy is? How is it expressed? Like, do they just go slightly faster? Like,
I used to think I could do this
twice a second.
It gets more excited. As well. That's a bit weird.
It's they get twice as effective after 18 minutes of surviving.
Okay.
So most Suck-on 2 games don't even last that long, really.
Yeah, fair enough.
Tom.
Hello.
Senior. Sorry, I should specify.
You're looking at me, which is
They're helpful, but people on the internet, phone, radio, whatever this is, couldn't.
When we find them personally and dictate our podcast.
I should have a cup of coffee over the start of this podcast. You have been to play Dishonored Knife of Dunwall, which is and you wrote a thing about it for the site, but.
Yeah.
Tell us about it's the big story DLC, correct, for Dishonored?
Correct. And you play as Dowd, the assassin who kills the Empress, the jerk who kills the Empress
Michael
at the start
Madsen.
Of the game.
Would you like to be that jerk?
Yeah. You get to be that jerk across three missions, and each mission is a proper Dishonored level, based on I only played like the hour of the first one. I was probably only about 2/3 of the way through it. So it's big mass environments, and it's all the places you've kind of heard about in Dishonored and kind of wanted to see, but never went to.
There's a whaling yard, yeah?
So it's a whaling yard, the first one. It's kind of a whale processing factory, but it's set in the docks. So on the way into it, you get to see these beautiful docklands, and you get to see all those amazing boats with the kind of whales hanging off them. And then you actually get inside the docklands, and it's fucking gross. It's just, you get inside the whale processing plant, and it's just whale guts everywhere. And you walk into a room, and it's just a giant whale corpse with like this rib cage coming out the middle. And then you hide behind the rib cage from this guy, you know, the whaler guys who have these chainsaws. And it's really disgusting, but really interesting place to explore.
Does Dowd feel substantially different to Corvo? Because my concern would be that it's just Corvo with
no,
the red jacket.
No, he feels exactly the same as Corvo. In fact, I think he stabs people in the same way. All the animations are the same. He's just got different sleeves.
New sleeves.
But his abilities are different. He kind of feels a bit like Corvo light. He kind of has fewer abilities. So he can't summon rats, and he can't possess people, and he doesn't get wind blast. But he can summon assassins out of thin air.
Like Ezio.
A bit like Ezio, but it's cooler than... it's funny in Assassin's Creed 3, because they have to have a physical way of the assassin getting on screen to do the deed, which is the funniest thing. So they appear from over a rooftop, and that must have been a really hard problem for them to solve, or they appear out of a hay bale. Whereas in Dishonored, because it's your Assassin crew are the Wailers, who are the guys you took out a lot. You killed a lot of them in the first game. They were the ninjas who are carrying on the rooftops in the gas masks.
Yeah.
And those are the guys you summon. And they just pop out thin air and stab a guy.
They blink, basically.
They blink, yeah, exactly. So they just appear behind the... It's like
Do they have really long-range blink, or were they hiding somewhere nearby?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure.
They're all just in the rafters all the time waiting for your pointing.
That's probably how it works.
Because they've got to see you point, right?
Like in the levels where you encounter them in Dishonored, you are encountering them on the rooftops, just kind of waiting all the time. Yeah. I kind of imagine that's
they're probably
doing.
Just waiting for Dow to pass and point at something.
Yeah, yeah. Go.
No one's seen him point lately? No.
And he instantly wanted to do a playthrough, which was just entirely the Dowd pointing at things playthrough.
Yeah, I think that'd be brilliant.
Yeah. It was just Dowd is just one
word. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to do a No Trace thing. I'm going to resurrect my old Dishonored Diary series for this DLC.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that actually breaks the whole thing, because I had that problem with original No Trace.
Yeah, you didn't kill him.
Where I said that I forced myself not to use rats after the first time, or to only use rats in an environment where it makes sense for rats to be. Yeah. So if a guy's in the sewers, you can use rats because it's kind of believable.
Mm.
But if a guy's on the top floor of a mansion, then it's unlikely, so you don't do it. But I can't really think of a situation where it's unrealistic. You know what I mean? If the goal is simply this person was killed but not by this guy, then you just constantly just point.
Yeah, I don't think it would fit for No Trace.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. I think.
Plus, everyone would have died by stab wounds, suspicious stab wounds.
Yeah, I suppose suspicious, but it's whether or not that guilt is reflected on Dowd as opposed to a different supernatural assassin. Anyway, go on.
His blink is slightly different as well. So when you actually hold down the blink button and you're standing still, it freezes time.
Yeah, I like the sound of that.
Which is actually a really clever addition, because it takes the twitch out of escaping from situations. So it's not just you don't blindly blink somewhere in panic. You can just stop and look around and just kind of see not just where you're going to go, but what you're going to do next after that. So you see, there's whale oil over there. I can kind of use that.
Because it was always, even in Dishonored, it was implied that there was some time manipulation going on with blink, wasn't it? The sounds kind of got distorted as you did it, and then they would kind of fade back in as you arrived.
I think there's a slight time distortion, but this one, I think, stops it completely, which is really useful, especially because I was playing it on an Xbox pad, which is just horrible.
Yeah, I'm going to need half an hour for this one.
Yeah, exactly. So it's so limiting just having the control on the stick, because actually I forgot how twitchy Dishonored was in terms of quickly getting places and getting around guards and things, and how much quick turning it required. And this kind of helps with that. So obviously, if time's frozen, you can choose exactly where to go.
Something you told me, actually, that I was really pleased about, is they've changed dark vision.
Yes, you can no longer see enemies with dark vision, and you can no longer see through walls with dark vision.
sounds like it doesn't do much.
So it's just vision.
Use your eyes colors. Power.
Yeah, yeah. What it does do is highlights objectives in the environment. So you can see, it's basically like before you'd point your heart thing when you're getting close to things. Whereas this just puts up an icon on the map when you've got that vision mode enabled. And you can buy favors before you go into missions, which will give you extra people to speak to and things to do and ways into places. You'll get a code to a safe, and then when you use your dark vision, you can see where the safe is and go get that, and that'll unlock a new way in, or someone else to talk to or something. And also, Dowd speaks, unlike Corvo, who is completely silent throughout. Dowd will actually have conversations with people, and people kind of know who he is as well. So there was a guy I met in the first mission who recognises, you're Dowd, you're that infamous leader of the Wailers, which is quite nice. So you're not like a ghost like Corvo was. Everyone knew about this masked killer, but it's nice to play someone who has a reputation in that world. It makes you feel more a part of it, I think.
It's that unmasked killer.
Yeah, that's right. In his suave, crimson-coloured coat.
Do they make any attempt to make him sympathetic or anything?
In a weak way. Yeah. So it's tough for them to do, because in the very first...
He does kill the Empress right
at the beginning. Yeah, but I mean, he is made more sympathetic in Dishonored anyway.
He is. It's kind of... Yeah, you see... this is the spoiler in the first 10 seconds of the DLC, but you see him kill the Empress as part of a cutscene, a non-interactive cutscene at the very start. And it's pretty brutal. He just blinks in front of her and you see the knife go into her chest, and it's all kind of horrible. And then it's just... it goes black and he says, there's a bit of voiceover that says, I realised then, I'm used to killing corrupt politicians, everyone in Dunwall's corrupt, and then I realised that she was different. And then he kind of has a bit of a sob about it. And then the outsider visits him and it's like, oh God, not this guy again.
Oh God.
And the outsider is as useful as ever. He's just, well, look what you did, Dowd. Yeah, I've had my eye on you, Dowd. Yeah, it's, like, you know, it's just like he was with Corvo. It's like, I've got my eye on you. You're destined for special things. How about that? And then he just goes, ooh, I'm going to give you a word and not tell you what it means. And that word is Delilah. Ooh. And then vanishes in a puff of smoke.
Fuck off.
Yeah, so,
I think the outsider becomes a lot more sympathetic if you imagine that he's winging it.
He can teleport, but that's it.
Yeah, he can teleport and show up people in their dreams and maybe set up obstacle courses in dreams to teach people how to blink, but he can't really do very much else. So the best thing he can do is show up and describe things that have just happened in a way that maybe makes him sound responsible. It'd be a bit like if you walked into the kitchen in the flat and like all of the dishes were done and beautifully put back into the shelves and things, and and I just standing there going like, something's happened to the dishes, Tom.
And then I turn around and there's a shrine to Chris in the corner. Little rune there. I was like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, like, what could have happened? Well, maybe you'll find out. I don't know.
Smoke bomb. Dive out the window.
You do have smoke bombs actually in the new one. Nothing could be a straightforward thing in Dishonored, so it's like a dust keg or something. I can't remember what they called it. You throw that and it
dust explosion.
It does explosion. It incapacitates people, and that's really good for taking out two people at once if you summon an assassin at the same time.
So is it like sleeping gas and also Heidi gas?
It's kind of
a holy alliance of Heidi gas and sleeping gas.
Our scientists have combined the two.
And don't hide in it; you'll go to sleep.
It's really good escapey gas.
Heidi sleepy gas. Yeah.
It's really good escapey gas. So if you get into trouble, you just throw it down and then vanish away. Like Dowd does, I think, actually.
But it doesn't lock you out.
No, it doesn't. No,
Ninja vanish.
It doesn't actually.
That's why they wear gas masks, I assume.
Well, we can't see him, but we can hear him snoring.
It doesn't actually knock them out. They just retch for a bit, which leaves them well exposed.
That's like Deus Ex gas.
Best kind of gas.
Chucky gas.
Yeah, chucky gas. Mild irritation.
I don't know how this ever got into Deus Ex, but it doesn't make any sense. The gas used, like, the reason it's useful is it incapacitates everyone. It doesn't incapacitate you, but it still hurts you. So you're affected by it, but you can still move around and shoot people. And that, like, they just care more about their eyes, I guess. And so they rub them a lot while it's happening.
His vision is augmented.
Yeah, true.
That's what the shades are for, surely. They just flips the shades on and he's completely immune to gas.
But it's fun that, like, locational damage is so cool in Deus Ex. Like, if you've been shot in the chest and then you got caught in gas grenades, then because the gas damages your chest, you would die sooner. So your lung capacity was reduced by the fact that you've been shot in the chest, which is awesome.
Good old Deus Ex. Yeah. A pretty good game.
Yeah, it was rather good.
Also, this is nothing to do with Deus Ex, but in games that have an O2 meter that is both your sprint meter and your oxygen meter, if you sprint into the ocean, you start drowning immediately because you're out of breath the second you're...
Which, to be fair, might happen.
That'll kill every child ever who runs into the sea.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, most baby turtles.
Yeah. And everyone in Baywatch would die straight away.
Lifeguards committed mass suicide by sprinting into the water.
The rookie lifeguards running in.
Don't walk into the water. You gotta walk. Jesus Christ. Run to the edge of the sea. Stop.
Yes.
Have a break.
Take it to
your
breath.
Wait for your stamina to recharge and then get into the sea.
That'd be disastrous.
Well, I'm glad that doesn't happen in...
Yep.
No, it doesn't happen in Dishonored. But the DLC looks awesome, and it's going to be really quite substantial. It's going to be like £8 as well, so I think it's definitely people who like Dishonored.
Is the pointing to make other people kill someone for you power, is that like a thing you buy with runes? And?
Yes, well, it only takes one rune to unlock, and then you can upgrade it, and that gives your assassins some of your extra abilities. I can't remember which ones exactly.
They can then point themselves, and it's just like recursive.
That would be amazing.
Just see them walking around the level pointing ahead of themselves. I'm going to kill this guy.
So they show up and kill someone, then point at someone else. And then they show up and kill someone and point at someone else.
Chain pointing.
I like the idea if you upgrade them, you summon one, and he just does the mission for you. And you just sit down and have a cup of tea.
And the last one points at you.
Well, these are all like yank things into like that finger gun fight from space.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it'd be awesome.
Like guards can be upgraded with the ability to point as well.
Yeah. That would be tragic. It was quite overpowered when I used it.
It does seem like a bit of a soul fall.
Yeah, yeah. You could also just summon them to your side in the middle of a fight, and it just helps you win fights as well. Oh, yeah. So it's not just like for a split second. If you just throw it at the ground next to you, he'll
point at the ground. Yeah. Like, you there.
Yes. Yeah. So goes, it's the same. The way you target your blink is exactly the same, kind of just a red version of that, and you'll pop out of thin air wherever you turn to.
I'd like to blink there, but I don't want to be me who arrives there.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's a lot of fun, though. I mean, being overpowered in Dishonored is kind of... You are overpowered in Dishonored already.
That's the point.
It's part of the fun, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
So it's another cool toy to have to use. which is sweet. Nice. Yeah, cool, cool.
But you can't be a fish.
You cannot be a fish.
No, and there are a lot of whales in the DLC. But they're all...
That's why they had to take out possession, because yeah, there's a whale.
They're all dead, actually. So and they're all hanging from hooks as well, so you possess a whale.
It sucks. I regret possessing this.
And would you still... And you'd be killed the whale by depossessing it, so...
Oh, yeah.
Anything like that
would be sad, wouldn't it?
Or the whale would just vomit.
Whales vomiting in misery after you possess them.
This is the saddest thing.
They probably made it and they saw that happen and they're like, no, come on, man. Now that I see a whale just barfing this stream of vomit from after being possessed,
I see now
the mistake we've made. We've gone too far. Revert.
God, yeah, that's...
The image of the whale, like, hung up by hooks, like, stationary, just injecting this torrent of blood. Ty just washing away guards.
There's all these guards. Like, they're all standing there, like, getting ready to carve this whale up with their buzz sword. It's like,
revenge.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, that's the worst job in the world. Bloody Dowd.
Pretty damn ghost. Oh, that's got to be the next DLC, guys. Arcane guys that are listening, Harvey Smith, man.
Barfing whales.
Barfing whales. Man. I can't play any of the games until I've played a game that lets me do that. Chris, what have you been playing?
Oh, God. I've been playing Heart of the Swarm, which involves a certain amount of vomiting as well.
Mm.
Like, the Zerg are all about excreting things and puking up on things and whatever. I've only just started playing multiplayer again, and like Wings of Liberty, StarCraft 2, kind of original, was my kind of competitive game for ages and ages, years ago, like when it came out, 2010, 11, when I was a freelancer and when I was working, sort of making my own schedule, and part of that schedule was always like three games of StarCraft in the morning and then work and stuff. And you'd think, so probably a comparable schedule to the amount of Dota I play now, which is for comparison. I have forgotten everything. Really? Like, going back to that game after a break of a year or so and trying to pick it up again, like, I remembered hotkeys and things, but in terms of, like, the brain space you need to be in to compete, like, I went through my placement matches and I'm in bronze, and, like, I suck now. Like, I really suck. And it's that kind of... it's not because they've added units and changed things.
Hmm.
It's like, StarCraft, it turns out, isn't like riding a bike. It is possible to go back. And
commanding
and totally
disgusting space armies is nothing like riding a bike.
Yeah, I guess it's that riding a bike is substantially simpler than remembering the exact timings of a three gate robo.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like,
it's always gonna be tough.
Like, and that has kind of been a bit sobering, because I kind of hoped that I would go back and all. I mean, one thing, I mean, my APM is better, and I think that's Dota. I think that's just Dota making me better at clicking on mans on the internet isometric
important
games.
Life skill in this business.
Yeah, yeah. But everything else has just sucked. But because the campaign, the single player campaign, has little bits of MOBA in it, you know what I mean? There's like, and you can tell that they're making Blizzard All Stars on the side because of like, you know, you have a hero unit, Kerrigan, who has sort of MOBA style abilities, who you control alongside the rest of your army and stuff. And there's a bunch of missions that add, for example, like a stream of enemies that come out of a single location constantly, or friendlies and always arrive at, you know, the same place.
Yeah.
You're kind of building your own armies to support something that's already happening in the map, which again feels like a MOBA. That, like, it sort of felt like, well, multiplayer has reminded me of how much I suck. Like, single player was much easier than I ever remember Wings of Liberty being, simply because I think those interim years spent playing a different game.
Hmm.
But you've played as well, Tom, haven't you?
I played a lot of the single player, but I've always been trepidous about getting into the multiplayer stuff.
But I really enjoyed the single player. Like, I think they continue that, given how conservative the game is as a strategy game. Like, we're talking about Supreme Commander, which is a game that genuinely tried a bunch of new things and expanded the scope of Total Annihilation stuff. StarCraft 2, it is StarCraft again, and it always has been. But the way they solve the same problem of people getting bored of old-style RTSs, I think is really... cool, just by changing the rules for every single player mission you play. And you always have that thing where you get into the next mission and the parameters for what you do and what your challenge is are completely different. And I played through the whole thing on hard, which I never managed to do for Wings of Liberty, and I've completed every side objective, and doing that was genuinely really tactically rewarding as well. So I think they did a really good job with it. The storyline is... kind of awesome in the way that Blizzard stories are awesome, in that they have all the money in the universe and like amazing art design and talent and cutscene teams and everything, and they are still some of the worst written games. I mean, in a way that's actually fine, and I can't, like, because it's almost like they're, I wanted to say like Disney movies or something, but Disney movies are often very well written. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's something like they're big and chunky and kind of fun, but yeah, like individual lines of dialogue can be like skin-crawlingly dreadful.
Yeah.
There's actually a line right at the end of the Heartless Woman campaign. Like, I think it's the final line, bar a small bit of narration at the end or something.
That proves I'm your mother.
Yeah. No, they're actually quite well delivered. Like, a character says something in a way that's kind of like understated, and it's quite sweet. And it actually really took me out of the experience momentarily, because I was so used to kind of like Diablo style, like massive statements about everything. And the story focuses on Kerrigan, who's the Queen of Blades, put it this way, whose fate at the end of Wings of Liberty was ambiguous in a bunch of ways about how that was going to play into Heart of the Swarm.
Mm.
So after three missions, they just undo most of it. it's basically the story about someone making an incredibly big decision on the flimsiest possible grounds.
Yeah, I mean, there are many reasons to take control of a hive mind of disgusting alien creatures and sweep the galaxy, therefore dooming it. But
the reason
love for Jim Rayner is probably not one of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, love for Jim Rayner is one thing. But it's also the way in which that's framed is, like, I mean, a bit like Diablo has always telegraphed its twists so far ahead of time that, like, I remember playing through Diablo 3 with you and Tom Hatfield, our flatmate, and literally all of us calling the twist in Diablo, like, two acts ahead of time, like, what it was. Because, Blizzard foreboding is pretty much just telling you what's going to happen.
Mm.
And there's the early twist in StarCraft Heart of Swarm is so clearly telegraphed ahead of time that everything Kerrigan does in response to that information is dumb. Like, and to the point where when someone calls her on it later on, it's sort of like, yeah, we know, like...
It would have worked better if she'd, like, her whole thing is that she doesn't quite remember what she did when she was Queen of Blades
yeah.
And therefore, but is scared of that. Where it would have been more convincing if she kind of hates herself for it, but secretly loved being in charge of a giant alien army and wants to do it again. And therefore, that's actually part of the reason why she goes back.
Preferred it when I was purple.
Yeah,
could I be purple again, please?
The wings that don't actually act as wings. I love those things. Currently fit through doors, but, you know, I look badass on a battlefield, and that's all that really matters.
Yeah, I love saying things like, I am the swarm, over and over again. Like, I miss not saying that anymore. Or, as she likes to say in this game, Mensk will pay in every mission.
Like, well, whatever she's doing. Like, she's like, Mensk will pay.
It's one of her, like, movement right-click things. Yeah. So you get, like, well, some of them are like, you know, like, I'll make haste or I'll be there soon. And one of those, Mensk will pay. Going to the shops. And, you know, towards the end of the game, that makes sense as being what's on her mind.
Return to resource patch. Mensk will pay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't get Kerrigan to pick up resources. But there's a bunch of cool things about it. Like, you can upgrade Kerrigan, like, and her abilities and things to meet someone who requires sort of more micro. I think the one thing I kind of noticed about it is you have three lines of abilities, and you move up those lines essentially, and you can pick any one of three abilities at each tier. Mm. I mean, you can swap them at any time, but it feels like the way it's set up is like the leftmost column is the easiest, most passive abilities, the middle column is somewhere sort of in the middle ground, and the rightmost column requires the most micromanagement.
Yeah.
And I think that's how they built it, is so that if you just click every single rightmost ability, you get a much more powerful Kerrigan who requires much more babysitting.
Yeah.
And which is kind of an interesting idea, but it felt towards the end when I was kind of happy with all that stuff that it kind of took the choice away, because it was like, oh no, this does seem to be measurably better.
Yeah.
Like, an example would be the very top ability for all three, the best ability in the game. One of them, the leftmost one, is called, like, Apocalypse, and it's this massive psychic explosion that kills everything in a huge radius, which is great. It's very easy. You just click on enemy army, and enemy army goes away. And then the second one is summon Leviathan, which brings down her, like, massive ship, which isn't actually that big, which is powerful and has its own abilities, but it's one unit, and you can kind of click on things and blah, 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 and it's useful for a while. It's got time. It can die, but it's also on a timer, so it vanishes after a certain amount of time. And then the third one is Drop Pods, which brings down, like, 40 Zerglings, 5 Hydralisks, 5 Roaches, which, if you know how to use them, are more powerful than anything else, because it's sort of instant army. And if you've got the micros, make sure they're in the right places, or maybe, like, turn the Hydralisks into Lurkers or whatever, then, or turn the Zerglings into Banelings, then you can do much more damage with those than you would be able to do with either of the previous two abilities, but it is scaling up in its hard it is to achieve, which I think is a clever way of building on like an RPG around the principles of StarCraft as they already exist. But by the end of the game, it did feel like, okay, this is just more powerful. Hmm. Like, the ability to just drop.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I like the new units you get. So you get new units very regularly, but also you can evolve units into different versions of themselves, which is really exciting. So you can have your Banelings jump up cliffs and then jump onto people, which is just brilliant. Even though I went for the other one's really good as well, where every time they hit something, they become two tiny Banelings, which then hit something else, which so creating a bigger tide of death. And they all look different because Blizzard throw massive resources into their art and stuff. And
although later on you get some variants, which is like the green, they're all the green one or the purple one, basically. Like,
kind of, yeah.
Yeah. The one of the Ultralisk mutations is insane. Like, one of the Ultralisk mutations is it just has this, like, occasionally it lets off a little explosive AoE, which is good, but it's not crazy good.
Okay.
Whereas the other Ultralisk mutation basically turns it into Skeleton King from Dota, where when it dies, it comes back to life. And then, but that's on a timer, so if you kill it twice in quick succession, it's dead. But if it survives for a minute, then it's recharged.
Jesus Christ.
And so, and it goes into a pod for a bit, and then just comes out. And it's like, so you can do that thing where you just build like 10 Ultralisks and like put them on attack move to the back of the enemy base, and they just keep going.
And you're gonna have to kill more than 10 a minute.
I do like how they use the single player as an excuse to build units that are just really fucking overpowered. Yeah, but like, I've got the Zergling upgrade that means that whenever you spawn a Zergling, they spawn almost instantly, and you get 3 Zerglings from each drone rather than 2.
I think they're as powerful as well.
Yeah, and they're as powerful.
Yeah.
I got 3 Zerglings for your money, and then I got the upgrade that splits Banelings, and you turn Zerglings into Banelings. So, like, you just create, like, you get massive amounts of Zerglings from 2 hives really, really quickly, and then turn them into, like, so you get maybe 24 Banelings out of that, and then each one of those Banelings becomes 2 Banelings. And that, basically, nothing the campaign threw at me could ever really deal with that quite cheap
two minute bane bust, basically.
Yeah, and you know it's sort of like, you know, we've got this big line of siege tanks and Thors and things, and you just, like, attack move, and then you have whatever your actual army is, but you just do that first because why not?
Yeah. Oh no, it's the wave of roly-poly explodey enemies.
Yeah. I love can't deal so with those they guys. Are adorable.
Yeah, they are cute.
Although I think one of the interesting things about it is, like, it does, I mean, StarCraft's always done this, but it does fully humanize the Zerg. Like, they are just people that look a bit weird. Like, you fly around in your ship, which is this big living thing, and your command center is basically the thing's mouth. And you land on a new planet, and the mouth opens, and you can see the skyline of the planet you're on.
Yeah.
And you've got, like, your advisor, who's like a tentacle that comes out of the ceiling.
Tentacle lady, yeah.
And you've got, like, your evolution monster thing, who is, like, he's voiced by Steve Blum, I think, so it's Grunt from Mass Effect.
Yeah.
And he sounds like Grunt, and it's that guy. But, like, they don't even bother to put, like, voice modulation on some of them, like, tentacle from the ceiling. So it's like, hello, I'm the ceiling tentacle, and I'm here to tell you mission objectives.
She has such an annoying voice actor.
Yeah.
Her performance of that is she speaks so slowly all the time. It's like, I'm the Queen of Blades. I can psychically manage 1,000 troops at the same time. You could just tell me things a little bit faster. Just beam it straight into my mind, whatever. Just give me a pocket pop-up box, anything. But she knows she's there. She's like, you need to go to the next planet, because upon the next planet, there are more creatures to... Shut up! Shut up and let me go! And you carry on.
Yeah. Anyway,
that was fun. It's a good game.
It is a good game.
Badass.
The other thing that we've both been playing, Tom,
we've
reviewed, is Mass Effect 3
Citadel DLC.
Don't
spoil anything.
Which we won't... Yeah,
we're
careful not spoiling it, because, one, Tom hasn't played it, and two, people listening to this might not have played it, and it is genuinely... brilliant. In fact, all I really want to say about it is that I played it all in one sitting. So it's like a main story set on the Citadel during shore leave. Normandy sort of needs some repairs, so it's an excuse to have the crew on the Citadel for a story. Mm. And that story lasts about 3 hours. And then there's like another 4 hours of just stuff to do on the Citadel, like going for drinks with your friends and having a party. And it's like, I mean, I've spoken about Mass Effect at length on the podcast before. I think that's probably like... It sounds like fan fiction, and it kind of is, but the people writing the fan fiction are the developers, and I haven't laughed that much or like had a smile on my face for that long playing a game, I think maybe ever. It's
Tony Ellis, our production editor, called it the greatest achievement of mankind.
It's so good.
And he's quite reserved with his praise.
Yeah.
It's It's like there's a shot in the trailer, and it doesn't really give anything away, that like it's the first time in the history of the game they've just gone fuck it to the whole, you know we, a small squad could break the perimeter and we'll send three people.
Yeah.
You know, they explicitly hang a lampshade on that and says, no, we're sending everyone. So they do a mission. They find a gameplay reason to have you control three, but everyone is present, which is great anyway, because it allows all the characters to have lines and to talk and to talk to each other and to like banter and things. And
why don't they just do that for all three games all the way through?
Yeah, and yeah, no,
it's a bit of extra work, but
and there is an amazing kind of everyone firing at once sequence, which you can tell they've wanted to do for ages.
Bit of an Avengers moment. It's good.
Yeah, but the whole everyone firing thing is kind of the way it is, because like throughout, I think Mass Effect 3 is actually the funniest game in the series in terms of just the writing. Hmm. And but its characters are funny in isolation. Like people just get get one liners that are funny. That's the way humor has always worked in Mass Effect. Is you get these little odd little moments that then become cult moments when you know Tali says something funny, or Garrus says something funny, or Ashley's drunk, or you know, or whatever, or little Easter eggs. And Citadel is just that all the time.
Pretty much, yeah.
I like how a lot of the things that become memes from Mass Effect are lines that just have no kind of significance on their own, like just Rex Shepard.
Yeah,
it's the most quoted thing from Mass Effect. It's just
there's an amazing payoff for Shepard Rex right towards the end. There's an amazing payoff for the line, "I should go." Like, you know, the thing Shepard always says at the end of conversations is really stiff. The payoff for that is phenomenal. Like, as like the delivery on it and what happens subsequently. It's the great thing about it, and I think, you know, the criticism is that Bioware don't listen and blah, 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 blah. But a lot of these things are things that the players picked up on, thought were funny, and thought were a little bit out of place, and then they're fed back into the development team. Like Shepard not being able to dance, which started off in Mass Effect 1, is you could go to the dance floor in Phlox on the Citadel.
I think they just recycled a dance animation, didn't they? Someone else's,
And he does this sort of like weird little shimmy that I'm now doing, but you know, for the sake of like, this weird little sort of...
You know
little,
what it looks like.
Little groove shimmy. And it's completely sort of... there's no comment on it in that game. It's just, you know, an animation that plays, and people are like, wow, Shepard is a terrible dancer. And the fact that they have now, like, by the end of Citadel, the payoff for that is phenomenal. Like, and it's like... But it's like, we're gonna take that, we're going to run with it, and we're going to have people actually comment on it. And I think the best... Some of the best line delivery in the entire series is what happens about, like...
Garrus. I don't want to know anything.
Yeah, it's so good. I mean, that's... Yeah.
I think I like the direction of destruction that DLC has taken with Citadel and with... Knife of Dunwall, where they are really self-contained little adventures that work really well on their own. So with the Knife of Dunwall, it happens at the same time as all of those adventures, but in a completely different part of the city, and it's all about Dowd, and they get to do a thing that gives you a lot of choice over three missions, and they just end it and have it wrap up. And this is what Citadel's like as well. So it's so self-contained, and it does feel like the tie-in film for a great TV series, where they could just have loads of fun, and then you can fly away at the end of it, and that's it. You've had your 3-hour, 4-hour film experience, or whatever you want to call it, and that feels like a great thing DLC that can, what DLC can do to expand, not necessarily expand a game, but just give you those extra kind of bubbles in which developers can have fun and kind of do different things. Yeah, the same ideas.
I like it when it's stuff that wouldn't have really worked in the main game.
Yeah,
like you don't think, oh, it's a shame this was missing from the main game. Like the Dowd thing, just you would never ask for that in Dishonored.
Like Leviathan, which I really liked. One of them through Mass Effect, the first Mass Effect 3 DLC does feel like it should have been part of the main game, because it slots in to a part of the story, like the plot of Mass Effect, that I feel is probably necessary, and along with the extended cut for the ending, kind of does help the whole thing cohere better. Omega maybe is the same in that it's Omega super detached, in that it's like a pocket, it is the definition of a pocket adventure that doesn't feature the rest of the crew at all. It's just Shepard and a bunch of new characters, or characters that don't always aren't always around, like Arya, like on this separate thing, and it doesn't really plug back in. Whereas, like, both of those things feel like they are still part of the continuous story of Mass Effect 3. Whereas the interesting thing about, I've mentioned on the last episode of the podcast that, like, I had this diary for, like, when to play DLC in Mass Effect, where they best fit into the story.
Oh, yeah.
And Citadel, I loved it, but it actually kind of threw me, because I played it right before the latest point in the game where you can still do things before you trigger the final mission.
Yeah.
Which is when I recommend playing it, because the more stuff you've done in Mass Effect 3 and across the whole series, the more things happen in Citadel. But at the same time, narratively, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that they would take all this leave, like, shortly before the most important event.
Been working hard lately, guys.
And then...
Can you not play it after?
No, but, no. but the, you get a, when you finish Mass Effect 3, you I get a save no. that is, in terms of the plot, located directly before right, you trigger. Okay.
That's what I was asking, because I remember being returned to the ship, to the Normandy, but I didn't know
the point in time is, it's, there's a mission that you trigger that they tell you, like, there's no going back, yeah. and it puts you back before that point.
Right.
I mean, it does actually, it holds together if it happens then. But it does feel like it exists out of time a little bit from it, because it is so explicitly like a goodbye from the developers. And Rich, I was talking to Rich about it, who's also played it, and he said something that, full credit to him, I think is completely right, which is that, you know, whatever your opinion of it is, like, the ending of Mass Effect 3 is the ending, but this is like the ending of the series. Like, Citadel is actually the it's not chronologically the last thing to happen, but it really should be considered like the end, and like the last line in it. You know, like, it is BioWare signing off under this thing they've created over since, you know, over the last 6 years or so. And it that was kind of heartbreaking. Like, it's so kind of, I think they deserve their victory lap, and that's essentially what it is. Really, really recommend it if you feel, I guess, burned by Mass Effect 3, and a lot of people do. I think it's a great way of reminding yourself that I think everyone involved deeply cared about the thing they were making. And yeah. Also, it's very funny, and people talk about the story stuff, but you unlock like a virtual reality combat mode, which actually kind of works as its own little game.
Yeah, it's really addictive, actually.
Like, it works as basically Mass Effect by way of Bulletstorm or something, with these combo multipliers and these little self-contained combat challenges.
Yeah, you can unlock sidekicks from throughout the entire series and new enemies to fight and stuff like that. Yeah, it's really, really addictive.
So any squad mate from any of the games who's still alive is available, including all the Mass Effect 2 people who aren't in Mass Effect 3.
Yeah, it's good fun.
Awesome. Yeah. They should take more shore leave.
they should take more shore leave. Shall we do questions from Twitter?
Let's do it.
Of which we have many. The artist Daniel asks, who is Tom Francis?
He followed me right after asking that, so I don't know if I guess he probably knows. I don't know.
I thought you could answer that question quickly, because
I'm a writer and section editor for PC Gamer, doing that for 9 years.
human male.
And I'm off for 3 months now.
Oh, I don't know if we're going to actually say that or not.
Well, it's going to be noticeable, I hope.
It'll be noticeable. Well, I was going to sneak you back into the podcast. Explain.
I'm taking sabbatical to finish my video game.
Excitement.
So, after 3 months, I might be going back.
Depends on the video game does.
Yeah, and if I finish it, because it wouldn't be entirely out of character for me to think it was, you know, finishable very soon, and then 3 months later to not be anywhere near finishing it.
Well, good luck in any case. And as I said, this isn't your goodbye podcast, because should you release it and it all goes spectacularly well, we'll just have you on as indie guest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, awesome. Dan Price asks a question for me, which is, do I ever wish I was a Tom?
I think just be too confusing.
It's too many Toms. I live with two Toms. I'm currently on a podcast with two Toms.
Well, after today, Tom Senior will be the senior Tom. And in fact, the only one, so we can get rid of the tedious name confusion that happens literally 5 times every single day.
Yeah.
But you are not the French Tom, because that honor belongs to Tommy Francois. Ubisoft's, I think, PR manager, who is the French version of Tom Francis.
There's also called Tommy Francois.
Tom Sykes, one of our news guys on the site. Yeah. Yeah. I think there are I don't know what it was.
You don't have to be called Tom to work for us. But it helps. Thinking that.
But it's annoying.
There was a Tom bomb at some point in the 80s.
Apparently so, yeah. Everyone was called Thomas.
Thomas is not alone.
Certainly not.
Nick Wheeler asks, in an entirely turn-based universe, who would be king?
What, sorry?
In an entirely turn-based universe.
NFL champions, the New England Patriots, I suspect, with their ability to organise themselves in turn so well and kill all opposition.
That's an excellent answer.
I don't know what any of that meant.
I don't know, like Deep Blue?
The Drengin from Galsiv.
Pretty good, yeah. Gandhi.
Gandhi. I was just going to say
Gandhi from Civ 5, yes. It would be him, the fucker.
Nuking everyone.
Nuclear Gandhi.
Nuclear
what
Gandhi.
What an asshole.
Yeah.
I saw there's a Civ 5. I just picked up Civ 5 as part of, like, there's a Green Man Gaming deal of pre-order for Bioshock Infinite where you can pick any other 2K game. So I picked Civ 5 because I don't have it. And someone's made a mod that adds the Krogan from Mass Effect to Civilization led by Rex. And I think they do replace Gandhi with Rex. And someone was like, so, and it's like, yeah, no, this is completely...
Wow, this guy fits in all other respects. Yeah. So we have to just replace the portrait.
This is actually more accurate.
Gandhi, Shepard.
Yes, please. Tyler says... Would you guys want to see another Homeworld game? If so, which dev would you want to buy the license to make it? Yes. Well,
yeah, definitely. But actually, like, Homeworld 2 is fucking amazing on its own. And it's so pretty. There's almost no reason to remake it. I don't know what I'd do to it if I was to remake it. It's just beautiful. And there's a great mod for it, which I can't name now, but we'll link to in the comments, which... I think it's called Homeworld 2 Complex or something, Complex mod, which just gives every ship subsystems and makes it like every ship is like FTL and it has crew and stuff. And it's incredibly hard to manage, but it's incredibly
complex.
Detailed at the same time. Yeah. So Homeworld 2 is still amazing.
Homeworld 2 Complicated mode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Homeworld 2.
Homeworld
2
difficult.
Crazy.
But who'd we make it? Presumably Relic.
I'd leave it with Relic, yeah.
Yeah. They, ideally, quite good. The guy who made it.
That's not taking it away from the developer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oren asks, what do you think of PCG doing video reviews? He finds them good for getting an idea of gameplay and visuals with a review. I think it'd be up for doing it. It's one of the things where it's a question of sort of time and getting these things and sort of a cost-benefit thing. That's a dry answer.
It'd be interesting to, like, if you're looking for more of a sense of how the game looks and plays, then we could just slot in-game videos into our reviews. Or maybe, I don't know, there's probably a few
but I think
around.
But I think there are reasons why... we don't do it. Like, there are not reasons to, like, not do it ever, but there are reasons why in certain cases it's basically impossible to criticize a game well in video. Yeah. And I think an example of that will have been your Bioshock Infinite review just went up, which, in order to be spoiler-free, required heavily on talking, not around subjects, but finding analogies and finding ways of talking about things, so not just showing you it. And that's, you know, that's a huge problem with... like, it's a huge benefit of video is it expresses exactly what the game is like very clearly, but the weakness is sometimes you want to hold things back. You know what I mean?
It's really funny when you watch, like, preview videos that are made from B-roll footage. Like, the person's played the game and they want to talk about what they played, but they don't have footage of everything they talked about. And so they'll be making a point about one thing and they have to show footage of something. Like, there has to be things moving on screen for it to work as a video. So they're just showing completely irrelevant combat scenes and, like, your brain tries to connect what they're saying to what you're seeing on screen. Like, you mean that guard is emotionally troubled or what's happening?
Yeah.
So it's tough when you can't show certain things.
Yeah, I think, it's that thing of, I think there's... it's definitely something I'd like to do, and we are going to do more sort of like playing video with commentary and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I will always defend the long form written review.
Yeah, I think
having a lot of qualities of its own. That
we did a thing where we filmed a Supreme Commander game, and Tom and Graham just sat and talked about it. And I thought, like, that's a great way of showing people how a game plays out and the banter that happens, and people explaining it, and, you know, the things you can't see by just watching a man shoot a man. You say, oh, this is this power, and you can explain it in a deeper way. Without necessarily passing judgment on it, in without, you know, needing to have the level of control that you have over a written review, because there's no score on the end of it, so you're free to just explain what it is.
Yeah,
but I don't know. We'll think about it.
Yeah, it's certainly something I'd like to do.
Yeah.
Sean DeVries asks, "What games would you recommend playing for someone who works, goes to school, and for whom time is precious?"
FTL, little 10-15 minute.
Yeah,
roguelike adventures.
I definitely agree with that.
I was going to say, it's one of those things where I think there's two answers to this in my head. One of them is, like, if you just want something that, you know, is kind of reliably excellent, then I think competitive multiplayer is kind of the way to go with things. Like, you know, a match of StarCraft, a match of Dota, a round in Counter-Strike, whatever it is. Because it's something you can continue to improve on that is functionally bottomless, but also short play sessions. On the other hand, if you actually want to be told, like, a meaningful story, just look at, like, the best and most highly rated RPG series and slowly play through them at your own pace.
The Walking Dead's good. That's like
Walking Dead is good.
A sit down session.
Yeah,
it's
episodic.
I think the answer is don't play an MMO.
Oh, yeah.
I do worry that sometimes the pressure to make games longer and for, you know, people who bitch about, oh, it's only 60 hours, not 100 hours, sometimes makes games slower. It's really painful when you play a new game and you know they've kind of... they can't give you any new abilities for the first, like, hour and a half because they've got to spread these out over a 40-hour campaign and then, you know, a 100-hour sandbox mode. And I I'm kind of getting to the point now where there are some games where I just think, I am just never going to have time for this. This is just like, if it was the best game in the world, I would make time for it, but you can't ask 100 hours of my time just to get to the good stuff.
It's what kind of why there's a shame there aren't like lower tiers of charging for games, where if your game doesn't have that much stuff in it, you could charge a little bit less, but people feel like there's this one price that games have to be, and everyone's striving to meet that. And,
yeah, it is ridiculous.
Like MMOs, for a while anyway, were allowed to charge a subscription fee and in exchange for the ridiculous amount of content they had. But like Mass Effect isn't allowed to charge $200 because it's fucking 10 massive, times longer than a $20 game.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's... It's just like, don't play bad games is the the bottom line. And I think, I don't know, I think there's a lot of kind of acceptance of just like, yeah, I'll play through this even though it's crap. Whereas actually, like, I guess what I've lost as I've gotten older is I just won't play games that are crap anymore.
Bioshock Infinite's good, even if you don't have much time, because it's kind of split up into districts of the city, and it's so kind of spectacular and like fascinating and so beautifully made. That you'd always, even if you're going to pay for half an hour, you'll have a really cool time.
It's kind of the problem I have with Total War, where you can go for 2 hours in that game and nothing especially exciting happen. and managing an empire of samurai should be exciting at least once every hour. It feels like, you know.
There's an interesting podcast by John Schaefer, who designed
Civ 5,
and his guest on this episode of his podcast is Soren Johnson, who designed Civ 4.
Awesome.
And so they talk about all the kind of problems with Civ and how they each tried to solve them, and both of them feel like they failed with the end game, and particularly like just after the all neutral territory is captured and you're building up armies, they both feel like nothing really changes, and you still have loads of sort of admin work to do.
But war never changes, Tom.
You still have loads of stuff to do every turn. Like, you've got to keep moving your soldiers around. You've got to make sure you're defending this border. You've got to make sure all the workers are doing. But you'll just play for hours and hours and hours, and nothing has really happened. Like, it's just everything, the status quo carries on, and the person with the biggest military eventually wins.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I think it's my major problem with Civ is that. And that's why I've probably only played like one game of Civ 4 a year or something, because they always sort of seem to go roughly the same way.
Yeah.
Talking to the Rome Total War guys, their ideas for making sure that doesn't happen in Rome 2 are kind of interesting, in that like everything you've ever done up to that point is remembered by the AI, and sort of rebellions and power struggles within your own faction are kind of inevitable, so there should always be something happening that makes you concerned and that gives you something to address, not just moving your unstoppable force further across the map. Yeah. I think doing that without making it annoying is going to be the trick. That, you know, things,
the Dark Crusades campaign, in which you take territory and then the territory would be immediately taken back and you have to fight the same battle over and over again.
Exactly.
Keep hold of things. Yeah, that's always a problem.
Oren asks again, there's going to be a few questions from different people, especially Tunu on Twitter, who asked about 40 questions. So I'm going to sprinkle them throughout this, but not also answer all of them, because many of them were hilarious but unanswerable. So good job, everyone involved in our Twitter question spree this morning. Given the recent slew of HD or enhanced reworkings of old games, is it lazy when developers could be making new games?
No. Because it's not like they're spending the time and budget that it would take to make a new game. They're doing it because it's easy to fix an old game, and it's greatly appreciated by people who want to go back to it, but would rather it was look better. I like it anyway. I think like something... I've changed my opinion on slightly since making games is I really like efficient things where you can tell this probably didn't take very long to make, but it's really good.
Yeah.
You kind of feel like, that's, you know, this is good game design.
It's excellent use of everyone's time.
Yeah. It's really painful when you play a game that's like everything has been built by hand. You know, every scene has had to be built completely from scratch because there's no kind of game systems to it. And if the writing's bad in that case, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
Like, I have issues with Bioshock Infinite's plot, but it's a game, and it has game systems, and it's fun to play, and so they don't make it a bad game.
Yeah.
Jack Baldwin asks, at PAX East, I spotted a Ubisoft pre-order booth with a big line. Why do gamers keep basing decisions on hype over reviews?
Because increasingly hard to get reviews out when the game is out, because there's kind of battle happening where... developers won't give code out until the game is out sometimes, and that makes it incredibly hard for you to get a review out on the day of purchase. And people will, if they're excited about a game, they want to buy it now or as soon as possible if they're really excited.
What was the line for, sorry?
It was a line for a Ubisoft pre-order booth. Which
pre-order booths? So
we don't even know what they're pre-ordering.
No, I mean, like, I think it's. I mean, you see these at expos. You certainly get them at. I've seen similar things at like the Eurogamer Expo, when like, retailers will set up a booth where you don't buy games there, but you just go to pre-order reg, put your name down for pre-orders.
Right.
It's part of the same. You know, I mean, obviously we've said this earlier with regard to like season passes and things. Publishers benefit massively from selling you the game before critics have had a chance to get a handle on it. And there's an interesting editorial on GamesIndustry.biz went up this morning, I think, about how the sort of the embargo system works and things. Yeah. So, you know, when a game is coming out for review, one of the conditions of getting it in time to get a review up for launch or whatever can be, you know, sticking to a particular time and date for launching the review. And often review copies of games come with these review guides, which ask you, you know, would you kindly not mention this or this? And, you know, most people feel free to completely ignore them, frankly. You know, you respect some things, like you don't spoil endings because that's ruining the experience for people. But at the same time, like, there's a lot of attempt to control the process, I think, that most reviewers just ignore. But at the same time, it's this back and forth where you have to sort of stick to things like embargoes and things, because otherwise you'll never get early access ever again and that kind of issue.
Yeah.
It's like how best you can serve your audience while still...
I guess the reason people pre-order is because they're super excited, and pre-ordering is just a click now. It's just a click on a logo and your bank account details are logged in to Steam, say, and there it is, your pre-order's there and it's down. And if they can be cancelled, then it's a no-lose situation for the consumer in some ways, because they've guaranteed themselves some extra stuff when it eventually happens, and they can cancel a few hours before, even if they don't. A lot of subscription services rely on that kind of the lack of people's inability to keep track of things they've
pre-ordered
or put, you know, like the Netflix free first month. They're just basically relying on you failing to remember to cancel that thing before the next payment pops up. And it's like that with pre-orders, where you, even if you're allowed to cancel it before, a lot of people just don't, and the money goes out. And it's like, oh, I've got this thing now.
It's funny. I don't, like, you know, the core of the question is sort of, why is this, like...
It's because people are susceptible to hype and being excited.
Yeah, people are susceptible to hype and marketing and things. Yeah, I think, yeah, there's a bunch of things that, like, we can do to try and... to like make it harder for people to be disappointed by that. But like, yeah, there's a
your
great...
mind always fills in the gaps with the best possible thing you want, doesn't it? Like, yeah, you it always doesn't... like, you imagine like, oh, how would I fill those gaps? Well, I'd fill those gaps with exactly the kind of game I'd like. Oh, it must be like that.
Yeah.
Pre-order now.
And there's I mean, I do find though that like it's relatively rare now that I'm genuinely excited about games coming out, but I'm in a privileged position where I've often seen things or spoken to people who have seen things, so I tend to know what's going to be good. Like, I have pre-ordered Bioshock Infinite so that I can preload it, but I have been working in an office with you who have played it and are capable of telling me that it's excellent. So, like, you know, yeah, it's everyone should really have that experience.
Yeah, I find that after 9 years of covering games and, you know, paying attention to who makes them and sometimes talking to people who make them and then seeing how teams change and sequels get made, that I don't trust anyone. There's almost nobody who I'll just buy their next game immediately, except actually some indie developers where I know Brendan Chung's next game will be by Brendan Chung and will therefore be brilliant. But even like, you know, Dishonored, I have to wait for you to tell me that DLC is going to be good because I don't trust it to be good.
Yeah.
And if they make Dishonored 2, I'll wait until like journalists have played it, even if it's not me, and checked that it's good, because it's just so incredibly common for sequels to be nothing like the original or just miss the point of the original or be made by different people quite often. Like, sometimes the sequel is started before the original's even finished, so the people making the first one couldn't be working on the next one.
I saw a great bit of bollocks marketing at lunchtime. Just reminded me of this. Where if you pre-order Bioshock Infinite, you get access to this Facebook game or this like web-based puzzle game. It's like a COG arrangement puzzle thing. Right. And it's based on a website. You don't have to sign up with your Facebook account, but it really wants you to, and then it can share things. And as you unlock these puzzles, every time you do a puzzle, you get to put a point in, you either support the Vox Populi or the founders, and you're making this sort of ethical decision or something. And it's kind of completely nonsense, but there's like 60 puzzles. And you can go to like the rewards screen, which shows you kind of what you've unlocked so far. And there's a bunch of like badges you get in the game itself, but there's also like in-game stuff in Bioshock Infinite, like resource boost early on, or a new ability or something like that, or a new passive ability. And in the it's like a row of in-game things you've unlocked. And if you beat like the first puzzle, you get all but one of them. And in order to get that last thing in the list, unlock that final box of in-game rewards, you have to complete every puzzle in this game. And I was like, what is it? Like, I just, you know, went on Google and searched to try and find out what it is. If you do every puzzle in the game, you unlock a set of images for your Facebook profile.
Oh my God.
Based on the faction that you put more points into.
Holy
shit.
So
you get like a cover image, like, which is like a banner for the Vox Populi, and a logo, and like a pre-order now sticker for your Twitter profile. Oh, and it's like, so you can imagine people pumping like an hour into of their life, or 2 hours of their lives into solving all 60 puzzles, only to be given the power. The exclusive unlocked power to advertise Bioshock Infinite. Such bullshit. And I really feel...
Oh, God.
Like, yeah. I wish, like... And it, by all means, the game sounds excellent, but I always feel punished for pre-ordering it by feeling, like, complicit with that nonsense.
That
and
with...
you only have access to that game if you've already pre-ordered it. So the explicit purpose of it is to say,
yeah,
I've pre-ordered it, you can go and pre-order it. Like, oh, God. What a load.
Horrible.
Yeah, guys.
I hate... having pre-order stuff. Sometimes, like, you get it as a journalist, like, just because you're given the game onto your Steam account at some point, either because you're reviewing it or just because it's added automatically. And so you get the pre-order bonuses whether you want them or not. And I feel dirty having them, even though I didn't pay for them. Like, I just feel like, oh, I wouldn't have bought this. I hate having, like, extra... I hate... God, the Deus Ex Human Revolution one was terrible, where it gives you, like, 10,000 extra credits when you start the game, which just ruins the economy. Now I don't have to make any difficult decisions for the first, like, 8 hours.
Yeah, it gives you, like, an amazing sniper rifle.
Because I can buy every single thing. Mm. Yeah, you get a sniper rifle that combines the best features of the tranquilizer gun and the regular sniper rifle, because it's both, you know, precise and silenced. So the interesting decision between those two weapons is gone. The interesting decision about whether to buy a practice point or spend it all on cool weapons is gone, because you can just buy both, and it just makes the game worse.
Yeah. In Tomb Raider, you can unlock Hitman Agent 47's weapons.
Oh, God.
You know,
that suits with her, like, emotional struggle with terms of killing people. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm just going to be an assassin.
Oh, look, it's an agency silver baller.
I remember there's some other such hit franchises. Yeah,
God, embarrassing. Anyway, Tom Berger asks, Bioshock underwater, Bioshock in the sky. Where do Irrational go from here?
I did an all over on the subject.
Yes, we did. And all over, if you're not aware, is the comedy page at the back of each issue of PC Gamer, the one that is printed on a tree. What did we come up with in the end for all the places that we could go?
I think one was on the back of a wasp. One was like a paper city on the sun. Because it was all, it was not impossible to build Rapture under the sea. It was impossible to build anywhere else.
No, yeah.
Which is, you know, doesn't explain anything. Yeah. It's strangely compelling.
Brilliant.
It wasn't impossible to build Wasptopia on the back of a wasp.
Exactly.
A brilliant bit of rhetoric. Yeah.
I'd like to see them do maybe a city inside the human body, like Incredible Voyage. That'd be good. It could be inside Hitler or something to give it the political angle.
Inside Hitler. I can sort of imagine Ken Levine doing that.
Yeah. We should probably dig that out. Dusty Gherkin asks, do you think the Leap Motion will make an impact on PC gaming, and will it be a good fit with the Oculus Rift? The Leap Motion, if you're not aware, it's like a little sensor bar that I think sits under your monitor, and it can like detect your hands.
Oh, that thing.
If you like, so you could like mime in front of your monitor.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why I'm doing it now.
I know what I mean, though.
Imagine fingers moving.
Yeah.
Don't think it would work with
it. Depends
Oculus
heavily on the game. Like, I think this is the one where people show that, like, doing finger guns in. You could point as Dowd.
You could point as Dowd. That would be cool.
Yeah, like motion cap Dowd pointing.
Yeah, that'd be sweet.
I've said this before. I think I'd like limited, like, incorporation of things like motion controls into regular games. So I'm still controlling mouse and keyboard, but then if I want to do something with my hands, like, for example, in a multiplayer shooter or first-person game, gesture to other players, I can just lift my hands and point or whatever, or give people the finger or whatever. Or, like, in Mass Effect, actually do Renegade interrupts by punching.
Mm.
You know, that kind of thing. That would be kind of awesome. But, yeah.
I kind of like the idea of using a dismissive flick to get rid of menus. Just to get rid of things that would ordinarily require to reach for enter. You just go, meh, no, don't want that, don't anymore. Yes.
Yeah.
Just those tiny little finger movements.
I really want to see like a control scheme that is doesn't require you to be stationary to combine with the Oculus Rift. but I don't think, from what I've seen of this thing, it's like resting on your desk, so there's a specific area your hands have to be in for it to sensor.
Yeah.
So I'd much rather have like gloves that were detecting your motion. And I watched a video of someone using a system like that with a virtual reality headset. And so his arm movements were being represented in the game by his digital avatar, like quite smoothly. And I think it was running an Unreal Engine. It looked very pretty. And he was seeing it all like direct to his eyeballs and moving his head freely. If you move your head and your hands, and it knows where your arms are relative to that, you don't actually, I feel like that's the kind of holy grail. Once you've got that, you're kind of done. Like, you don't really want to be able to track your legs so much because you can't, if you're going to be running long distances, A, you just don't want to run that far. Like, it's just quite exhausting. And B, obviously it runs into a lot of different control problems. Like, now you're 10 feet away from your PC. Or
have you seen that thing that kind of like 360 degree treadmill the guy's invented, which is like a basin that you stand in. It doesn't actually move like a treadmill, but it's like almost like a motion sensitive bowl that you stand in and you kind of walk up against the edge of. So you are walking in place.
Yeah, I feel like that's, you know, it's a cool experiment, but that's kind of the thing. Probably doesn't have that much potential in terms of, it's probably just not worth tracking legs because you probably just want to be able to hold down a button to move in one direction.
Also,
and your legs are pretty much just going to be walking or running.
Also,
not that much
looking like a total bell end is an issue. A bug at the moment, you might say. Like,
I really like the idea of, you know, having your hands are in the game so you can pick up and manipulate things that are in the game. And then you just have, like, you know, pinch your thumb and forefinger together to go forwards or something, or there's just some way of indicating you want to go forwards.
You look so kind of like...
stroke your moustache. Yeah. Touch your monocle. Could it go forwards?
Yeah, like, adjust your monocle to, like, forwards and backwards.
I guess you could point forwards.
Yeah, exactly.
No, like,
you point forward to your right hand to move, left hand for assassins.
I feel like pressing a button to go forwards is fine. I'm okay with that. I never need that to be replaced necessarily. But having your hands free to, you know, do really complex actions, like, totally free, you have to be in front of your computer and you've got your headset, that could be really cool.
I mean, the real victory for Oculus Rift and control systems like it will be in games that take place with whose characters are already sitting down, so pilots, mech pilots, you know, truck drivers, right? And B, already have custom controls, because the problem with mime or like having your hands be picked up by gloves or whatever is you're still not actually grabbing things. You can mime picking things up in the environment, but it'll never feel real. You'll have no sense of weight or whatever, as you probably wouldn't, because like you want to pick up some like huge two-handed hammer and like, Jesus Christ, this thing's heavy, unless you got like a friend who'll like pass you a sledgehammer at that moment. Whereas like if you have, you know, a decent joystick or flight simulator setup or a steering wheel or whatever kind of game it is, and an Oculus Rift, I can imagine that being kind of scarily close to, you know, or immersive in any way.
The main problem with the foot thing is step size and relative speed. So if you're walking at a certain rate, you'll be traveling at a certain speed in the game in order for it to feel convincing, which means you can't really set your character's walk speed, which is tremendously important in, because it would be tied to the walk speed of the person and the gait of the person.
Yeah.
And it'd be impossible to program around that or to design a game where the speed is set by the player at all times.
I mean, I genuinely would like to play something like Skyrim with that treadmill thing, because as an exercise thing, right? Like, literally, like, treat it like
this dragon.
Well, no, but like treat it as like, I play this for an hour a day and I go for a walk in Skyrim in my flat or standing on a bowl. Basically, I'm going to stand in a bowl in the living room with goggles on and I'm going to go for a run. And like, but like the idea that, you know, if you do want to get away from an enemy, you do have to actually run. I think it would be at that point, you can get rid of the stamina bar, right?
Right.
Like, you keep the health bar, you keep the magicka bar, because those things, I do have health, but you know what I mean? Like,
how do you balance the game, though? Because an Olympic athlete can run faster than any dragon in Skyrim.
I'm okay for Skyrim to be unbalanced for Olympics, for Olympic athletes. I'm not having a problem with that.
It's more of the dissonance thing, where you expect to move at a certain speed when you're walking at a certain speed, and how do you calibrate that with the player, when every player has a different walk speed and different...
You just have some way of... I mean, if these things can measure your movement speed anyway, you just map it, like...
Map it to the scale of the game. But there'll be cognitive dissonance about that would make
slower players larger. Bigger people, they'll be ogres. So they're only taking a few steps, but they're going really far.
We've detected your speed, and then you look at your character, just a blimp-sized monster.
You need to be a titan in this one.
I don't know how you do it. I mean, as long as I can see the correlation between speeding up in real life and speeding up in the game, I think you would probably calibrate it after a while. I think it's one of the things where it would be weird when you stopped and got back to the real world. And
you look at your feet and you see they're sliding across the terrain because your step size doesn't match your speed.
But yeah, like, there's definitely things to iron out. But
imagine playing Unreal And you're like, so fast. Yeah. And it's just like, and you take one step and you're just like, across the map.
So you move so fast. I mean, I think the thing that will be weird is jumping.
Mm.
Because, like...
you got to make that noise. No, you don't jump, you just make that noise.
Like, but also...
yeah, that's how you control it.
That's how you control it.
But like, for example, like, you know, imagine if it had, you know, it has some way of detecting jump, so it felt the pressure you exerted when you, you know, when you pushed off the ground and could basically anticipate how high you were jumping and how long it would take you to land.
Okay.
So that it kind of matches, which would be incredibly hard to do, but like, imagine if it could do that. You then have the problem in games that have any other qualifier on real life, like gravity or rocket jumping and things, where you jump and your character would still be going up and you would have gone down because of gravity.
Yeah. Mm. Like, or if your character's jumping onto something, like you're not, so you'd hit the ground later than they were.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many problems with the idea that like...
out of sync head bob as well. I think there's loads of ways in which we've had be really annoying.
many podcasts ago we had the instant vomit.
Can't handle this.
Like
the insta vom.
The one there's a point that was raised that I still think is really important, and I want to know what the Oculus solution to this is people outside of the virtual reality you're in need a way of alerting you that they want your attention that doesn't scare the shit out of you. Like, you know,
stabbing you.
Like, you need to have like a little remote that you put in the room, like next to you or near you, that if someone presses the button, a little flash indicator flashes up in the game that says, you know, someone's trying to get your attention. You. Like, outside world needs you, and then you can, you know,
your child needs food.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, and then, you know, and then you can like take your goggles off and say, what?
Get out from the middle of like, this.
The simulation
fight,
was real. You have actually killed 13 people.
yeah, exactly. But like, because you can you imagine, like, you know, you're in there, you're in the living room, you're standing in a bowl, you're jogging, and then like someone taps you on the shoulder, and like you immediately punch them.
That's the future.
Like, and then vomit.
Knock them out, then vomit on their body.
Like the whale and something.
Well, possessing a whale and
I wanted. I want to be in the Oculus Rift while possessing a rail, while vomiting. It's on it.
So you can vomit in sync.
You're then right. Sympathy vomiting with the whale.
You make the noise like that, and it goes. You can actually tie it to your voice as well.
That's the worst.
This is a sensor on the visor that detects the flow of vomit from your mouth. Okay, yeah, the whale will be vomiting quite a lot.
Real time vom. Vom FX.
Vometrics.
Exclusive to NVIDIA.
I'm going to pick up the phone to Microsoft after this podcast to get this thing on.
Why?
Because record the conversation.
So, the Leap Motion, good. Yeah,
right. Yeah, I guess Adam, so.
Good. Adam Dawes asks, what's your earliest computer gaming memory? Mine is playing Nightmare Park on a Commodore. Now that was exciting, he says. Anyone want to go first?
What happened? What happened in the 90s?
Mine is, I think, a game called Felix the Cat on the 286, which was a, not Manic Miner, a Balderdash clone that I suspect remains the best thing ever, and I haven't got back to it in
best not to find out
22 years. So yeah,
my earliest memory there was a Noddy minigame collection, so I must have been extremely young when I played this, which was otherwise
he was 19
otherwise completely tame, apart from one game which was terrifying, where you were in an underground maze and you had to run away from witches forever. And it was,
like in Noddy.
I know.
Noddy's just screaming and crying all the time.
Like Noddy, the Dark Descent.
Fucking, it was like Amnesia. And it's a 2D side-on thing, and you're just trapped in these tunnels. But there's no way out. And there's no... You'll Noddy. Always die.
Noddy, a machine for big ears.
And it was... I remember being very scared playing that thing.
Yeah, my earliest memory is also a terrifying game, so maybe that's just that's the key, first one that sticks. It was Granny's Garden, which was was it supposed to be educational or something? I remember it was on the BBC Micro, and it was a series of screens where you kind of solve puzzles like, what's the secret word? And you're looking at a house, and for some reason just the word fig is written on the house in really like letters that sort of semi-disguise as parts of the architecture. Mm. And so like you just say fig, and then you pass. But then there's one like, there was some... Richard Cobbett did a crapshoot on it, so if you want to read more, it's look for it on PCGamer.com. It's called Granny's Garden. But some of them were just like the equivalent of pick a card, and if you pick the wrong one, you're killed instantly. Hmm. And there's no way to know what it is. It's just purely random. It just changes every time, and if you get it wrong, then you die, and you have to go back to the start of the game. And every time you die, you get eaten by this horrible witch, the granny of the title. and had this like terrifying music, and she had, her whole face fills the screen. I remember pixely teeth going.
It does go like that.
Chews through your bones. Mm-hmm. So that was a good thing for kids.
I was terrified of the Home Alone game for the Amiga. Like my first like color computer was an Amiga 1200, like family thing. And I think the first game we ended up playing on it was the Home Alone platformer that I thought was terrifying. They had to set up traps for, I mean, to be honest, Home Alone is a terrifying premise for a movie. A child defends home against trained criminals.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember that game. I mean, and I think it was probably just a crap like object placement, like, you know, object finding and placement game, but I thought that was like pant-wettingly terrifying at the time. Wow. And again, I also thought the second level of Sonic 2 was pant-wettingly terrifying.
Which one was that?
The tube one, where I was pretty sure that at that time I didn't understand bosses, and I was pretty sure that Dr. Robotnik could show up any time. I didn't understand that the bosses would always happen at the end of the level, so that he would just, I assumed that like at any point you're in danger, but like the nemesis in Resident Evil 3 of having this boss show up and like burst through a wall.
That was a scary game. The nemesis playthrough of Resident 3 was great. Yeah, so that fear is the key.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We all go into games because like our earliest experiences were all uniformly terror. Good. Keith Baker asks again, you're adventurers and have an animal companion each. Things get bad, you're forced to eat one of them. Whose animal gets eaten?
Do we need to decide what
animals they would be?
I'm not taking the cow in this case.
Yeah, exactly. I should have actually made you choose animals
before I went.
I would have chosen a frog, and so I think I'd be fairly safe.
I was going to go for like a minor bird, so I'd have someone to talk to.
I was going to go for an armoured penguin.
This is also your spirit animal.
Yeah, I'd have him as an animal friend as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Double up on these things.
So yours has got the most fat on it.
I think the penguin would probably give us the most energy to survive, and also we could kind of.
It is armored, though, so can we actually
can we take the armored penguin? Is the question.
If it just kills us all, it's going to be really embarrassing.
Yeah,
seems they ran out of food and then attacked their armored penguin. Big mistake.
Do you find that as an audio diary? Like day 32, we're considering eating Tom's armored penguin.
The vulnerable frog.
Yeah.
A minor bird, which is also easily killed and eaten, or the armored penguin. We're leaning towards the one with the most fat.
This is research team Delta signing off. Sound of gunfire.
No, not the eye.
Are there any like?
He's so armored.
Are there any funny games with audio diaries? Like, there are some little jokes in most of the sort of the System Shock lineage of games and in Deus Ex and stuff, but. Are there any that have just...
I'm not sure there are, actually.
...outright comedy audio diaries?
I've decided that...
there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah.
I've decided that stranded World War II Japanese airmen are the new previous research team of games.
Yeah, they're coming up a lot, aren't they?
Like, as opposed to the guys who are like, you know, we're investigating further into the ruin. They're now like, we're investigating further into the ruin, but we're from World War II.
P.S. We're soldiers.
Yeah, okay. So we did agree on the penguin then, if we can take it.
I think we should. Yeah, we'll give it a boss fight. It'd be a good boss fight. I think we should do it.
Penguin or die trying.
No. Yeah, you go hard or you go home. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I mean, nonetheless, it's a shame that we... Carlos Rojo asks, if you could choose a video game character to be stuck with for a 5-hour car ride, who would you choose and why? His was Solid Snake.
I would choose one who can drive because I can't.
Yeah, I can't drive either.
So I'd be like, okay, can you take over?
I would choose video game character Colin McRae.
Best of drivers.
No, who would I pick? Who's good at driving?
Nico Bellic seems fairly safe.
No, not at all.
That's what he's doing.
Nothing wrong with him.
Always going bowling.
I don't think there are many video game characters I could be with for an hour. Often so angry.
It doesn't specify it has to be the player character, right? So it could be
I think it'd be any character from a game.
So maybe Roman Bellic.
I would be stuck in a car for 5 hours with Roman Bellic.
Well, I don't want to be, but you can drive.
I never spoke to him again. As early as I could stop him speaking to him and hanging out with him. But apart from the missions I had to do, I never spoke to him. GTA characters probably aren't a good bet.
That's not a good bet. Let's think.
I got a lot of questions for Elizabeth in Bioshock Infinite. Oh, yeah. I don't think she'd be able to drive, but
it's just plot questions. Well,
it's a very story-driven game, and there's lots of big mysteries, and sometimes she knows things that you don't, but there's no way to ask her. There's no like button to say, "Hey, Elizabeth, what about this thing? What about that?"
Maybe Eli from Half-Life 2, because I just kind of want to ask him about Black Mesa.
It'd be nice to hang out with.
Yeah, it'd be cool.
He's got some stories.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, oh, so what do you guys work on? Any other, you know, the port gun, but anything else?
But with his, like, hook leg, can he use an accelerator?
He's got a modified car, he's fine.
Have to be an automatic.
I don't know. I think that's a good shout. I was going to go for maybe Anderson from Mass Effect. He's got war stories. Seems like a nice man.
Oh, yeah.
He drives places.
Oh, yeah. Good answer.
Cool. Keith Baker again asks, complete the sentence. My favourite type of DRM is blank.
The indie game Death Row Manta.
Hey, excellent answer. Mine is unintrusive.
Blank, as in there is none.
Smartass. Keith also asks again, choose your life narrated by Logan Cunningham, who's the narrator of Bastion.
Oh, yeah.
GLaDOS, the announcer from TF2, or the Predator from Aliens vs. Predator?
Two of those are by the same actress.
Yes, they are. Two of them are on the thing.
I go for GLaDOS, obviously.
Bastion, but sorry, narration by the Predator from Aliens
vs. Predator, which presumably just be like.
Weird. All I ever do is heard him scream in pain, and sort of breathe heavily. That's all I hear from Predators.
Yeah, Tom.
It'd just be a man breathing heavily into your ear. It would be really strange. Deeply disturbing.
And then, like, howling when you die.
Yeah.
GLaDOS doesn't really narrate in Portal, does she? She's just, like, she's playing pre-recorded announcements sometimes, and then she's mocking you, and then she's, like, trying to change what you do. She doesn't really just describe what you do.
No.
So I'd be interested to hear her describe what I do.
Yeah.
I would probably go with Bastion guy as well. But I would substitute the Unreal Tournament announcer over everything I do. Yeah.
Denied.
Just, yeah.
It would go off a lot.
Yeah, exactly. crossing the road, double crossing the road, triple crossing the road. Holy shit.
If I had the TF2 announcer, I'd get, you failed. Just every time you did anything wrong.
Alternatively.
Slightly overbrewed my coffee. You failed.
I just like one, this voice haunts me. You're going the wrong way voice from F-Zero GX. Yeah.
You suddenly, like, you walk into a job interview and you just hear that. Like, you're going the wrong way.
I'd like it to highlight
a doctor.
Ongoing existential angst, basically.
Yeah. I'd also go for Storm Spirit from Dota, whatever. That's not going to mean anything to anyone here, but he is fabulous.
The worst one would be the Outsider from Dishonored.
Hey,
I see you doing this, Tom. You sitting in the podcast. Yeah.
I'd get medication to stop the voices so fast.
I listen to your podcast with interest.
I have one word for you. Iceberg. Ooh, what does it mean?
Yeah, you go, suddenly you're in Sainsbury's and you're looking at a lettuce. And you're like, oh my God. He knew. Incidentally, in Tomb Raider, they constantly yell, "The Outsider is here! The Outsider is here!"
Not that jerk again.
Because that's Lara Croft's nickname in Tomb Raider. That jerk again, showing up, telling us what to do.
It's like a shit G-man.
He is a shit G-man. James Oakes asks, what do esports need to do to gain more mainstream footing? Will their geeky origins always be a problem?
Always is a long time. So
true that.
A chance for people's minds to change. But I think for me, getting into it, it's like the casters did it for me. Just hearing guys like Day9 and Tasteless help me watch StarCraft and understand it and appreciate why it's exciting.
I think there are always going to be certain genres have an easier time than others that are easier to watch than others. And I think maybe the games we have now are still maybe too esoteric in some ways. Like, I don't know if Shootmania is there yet, but a lot of its ideas were really good in making an FPS look more like a sport, like getting rid of the like modern military weapons and the stuff that puts people off.
Yeah.
Call of Duty and saying, okay, it's Laser Quest, but it's virtual reality and there's all these extra rules we can have because of that. I think that probably would help a lot. Like, StarCraft is great to watch, but it's space aliens and monsters and blood and gore and stuff. Dota is great to watch, but it's wizards and bears and goblins and ghosts.
I find Dota very hard to watch because it's understanding the relationships between the powers and what they do is much more complicated than two armies just fighting.
Yeah.
Starcraft's fun because it has a fair number of units, but not that many, really. And so after you've watched it for a while, you know what all the units are, but you still don't know everything. And so having the, like, you know, one platoon of units moves out to meet another and the casters are telling you what's going to happen. Like, they're saying, oh my God, this is going to shred the Banelings because their Marines are so well spaced and, you know, this thing's going to kill that. And I played a bit of StarCraft 2, but I found I just learned so much about it from watching Cast with Texas and Artosis. Almost from, like, almost the way, like, a dog learns what you're trying to say. Just, like, I don't really understand what you're saying, but the tone of your voice, you sound really excited.
So you've learned the correlation between sounds.
They sound excited. They sound excited. It's like, what's going to happen?
Pavlovian StarCraft training.
I think as well, like, I mean, there's a visibility of players in esports, people to follow, and teams is sort of a blessing and a curse in some ways, because you get things like really interesting players and the really funny players like Dendi and Dota, and who you kind of like watching, and that's great when it kind of all comes together and the personality matches the your ability to like see people reacting and stuff like that and put a human face on things. But in some games, the lack of a human face does make it kind of hard to understand kind of why this person is, you know, what their character is and how the personality is expressed through the way they play and stuff. And then, as with that Call of Duty video that Eurogamer put up last week, sometimes you really don't want to see the human face because the human face is kind of being a dick.
Yeah, but footballers are dicks, and people still watch football. But
but I think it's like dispersed
dickery.
Yeah, dickery.
Dispersed dickery.
There's an amazing video Rich linked after seeing that. So the Eurogamer video you're talking about is one where a European Call of Duty tournament is happening in. Like, the two teams are in the same room facing each other, and they're talking shit at each other between the rounds.
They're not talking shit, like screaming, ripping headphones off and standing
pointing at their cock.
Getting
very aggressive. And then the interview afterwards, like, the guy seems quite reasonable. Like, so why do you do this? Oh, we just find it really helps us, our performance. Like, we just seem to perform better doing this, so, you know, we'll do whatever we can. But then Rich has linked to some videos of StarCraft players doing their crazy victory things. And normally, like, I watch a lot of StarCraft 2, almost all Korean players, simply because they're better than everyone else. And so they tend to form the top echelons of pros. And they are just the most emotionless looking people in the world. They're just like so impassive. And it's some kind of like cultural thing and kind of like a discipline thing. And it's considered, they're very sensitive to if you, like, if a player was to kind of laugh as he won, that would be like big deal. That would be like fucking hell, what a dick. Or he's so, what's the word? BM.
Bad manners.
There are some Korean players who are like that. And some who kind of form a cult personality over how rude they are. But it's still like MC's the one who's kind of famous for being a jerk, and he's really, really good, so he kind of backs it up. But the way he's a jerk is like, he's still completely impassive during the match. When he wins, he's completely impassive. When he loses, he's completely impassive. But then in interviews, he says really overconfident things, and that's his crazy personality. But then there are some, like, just every now and then, some StarCraft players just go completely nuts. And there's one Rich link to the guy who, his nickname is Steamed Rice for some reason. And so he comes out of his booth when he wins, and he's like, gets up quite calmly and leaves his booth. And then someone serves him like a bowl of steamed rice on stage. And he picks it up and just throws it across the room. And then he rips his shirt off and then starts running around. And for some reason, the tournament's on a beach. And so then he runs into the sand and he strips off all his clothes except his underwear. And then, like, actually
while
runs
doing
into
a dance,
the sea.
Remember.
Yeah, he's dancing all the time. And runs into the sea and, like, swims in the sea. And then comes back out of it. And then he's still just, like, standing there, like, half naked with everyone, like, trying to interview him and all the cameras on him. So he runs back up on stage and then he kind of doesn't really know what to do.
Yeah, that's the best bit.
And this was the semi finals.
And then the other one was a guy who had once taunted his opponent by saying that he was in the esports house where his whole team live, because they all live together to train together all the time. He was only good to do the washing up. And then when he beat that guy, in his booth, he brought up a bowl of washing up liquid and some dirty dishes to actually clean them in his booth to mock the other guy. Which I think is extreme bad manners.
Hilarious. More of that sort of thing.
More of that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of shit talking is acceptable.
Yeah.
Ivory Tusk asks, will there be crate stacking in Gunpoint?
No, you can't. There aren't even any crates, I don't think. There's filing cabinets. But it's not really
cabinets?
It's all offices, so there's no like warehouses or anything. So lots of office furniture and things like that. But actually, no, I tell a lie, because there are some labs. I think there are some crates in the background of those labs, but they're not interactable.
So your time to crate ratio is pretty solid for a
company. Yeah, I think, well, the only way you could do it, the fastest way to see a crate would be to, as soon as you earn some money, go into the shop and try out one of the gadgets, because you can try things out before you buy them. And you might be able to try one out in a lab that might have a crate in it.
Something to look
that'd
for.
That would be at least five levels in. So yeah, I think I'm all right on that front.
The next part of this question is, has anyone played Laser Cat and enjoyed its cheerful Metroid VVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVVV Link in the show notes.
Yeah, cool.
Daniel Owens asks, what is the most spectacular death in a game? Spectacular doesn't necessarily mean emotional, apparently. Just spectacular death.
Hmm.
Well, like Commanders in Supreme Commander.
Yeah.
Going nuclear, wiping out pretty an entire good. Base yeah. and ending the game.
Pretty
cool.
That's pretty badass.
Yeah, it's a good toys out of the pram moment. Yeah. That's, you know, they don't have to do that. They're just divas. I don't think I have a better one than that, Tom.
I don't know. I mean, in my mind, I just have this image of Lara Croft being impaled on the spike in a waterfall.
Oh, God. Actually, Jesus.
It's really horrible. And yeah, it's not really the sort of, I don't know, don't like it.
Mm, that's not spectacular so much. It's just like, oh, God.
Someone made a, I can't remember who did it, but made a gif of that on repeat and put it in the middle of the like Tomb Raider news story. I was like, what are you doing? Jesus. What are you doing?
He was on the, yeah.
I don't know. What,
yeah,
don't
know. I do know what that was, but I won't call it out. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, there's plenty of like death narrative games I think are kind of amazing. You can't really explain any of them without spoiling them.
Because
actual deaths in games tend to be
death scenes. There's some really good ones in there.
Yeah,
narrative heavy ones.
I definitely had like obviously I think it's happened to everyone. We have spectacular deaths.
Yeah,
I think one of my favorite spectacular deaths ever in a game would have been. I know this applies to both of us. Was when we were playing Battlefield 3 and we stole that forklift truck and covered it in C4
oh, yeah. And
had this whole plan to like, you know, go take a capture point, and we were storming down the beach with M1 Abrams rolling along outside us, and we were just in our little forklift truck, and I was stood in the back of the forklift truck unable to find my machine gun over the top of the truck because of the line of sight.
Yeah.
And then a sniper got a lucky shot off and hit the C4 and got more bang for his buck than he probably anticipated. And that's probably the most convoluted way in which I have ever died in Battlefield, at least.
I wish the battle recorder existed, because those moments of absurdity deserve to be recorded. And
yeah, I would love to see that from his perspective.
Exactly.
Like, oh, I'll take a pot shot, but what the fuck?
Yeah. Cool.
The Ninth Life asks, another day, another indie title I get all excited about, this time Banished, which is the kind of Settlers-like indie game made in Unity, I think, which we got this video up on PC Gamer, put a link in the show notes. Looks really, really nice, actually.
Yeah. Cool.
Why don't the big studios excite me so often?
It's a good question. And like loads of people, they're leaving big studios to go indie. It's becoming much, much more common, partly because of Unity. It's making it much easier to make things that look good. And something Graham and I say a lot, we've probably said it on the podcast before, is that if we were in charge of like a massive studio with, you know, several hundred people, we'd just say, look, if any of you want to form like teams of three or four and make your own indie games, use all our expertise, all our software, and, you know, whatever you like, all the things we have licenses for, and all that kind of stuff, and just prototype your own projects, totally up to you what you want to make. See what goes well, and if you feel like it's not going well, then stop it, start something else, or join someone else's team. And ones that seem good, we can put more people on really easily. We've got huge teams of artists if we need those, and then we'll just, you know, make the next Minecraft. One of them's got a bit.
Yeah. Infinite monkeys.
Yeah.
With the great reviews of Bioshock Infinite pouring in, asks Matthew McPherson, will the industry stop migrating to multiplayer only like SimCity?
Huh. I assume from his comments that he means great as in brilliantly written, and that he includes mine, in which case, thank you.
great way of wrangling that question into being a...
Yeah, if there's any way I can turn it into a compliment.
To being a compliment.
It clearly wasn't meant to.
I'll add that to every subsequent question so that you're more comfortable answering these. I don't think it will.
No.
But, like, I mean, I think there'll be... I mean... You know, we had a lengthy discussion about SimCity's problems on the last podcast, but like, I think there'll be hopefully more misgivings about it now.
Yeah, it really depends how well it's done, because I think I don't know how, why it doesn't have multiplayer, but I sort of, my instinct is that the publisher probably wanted to do it.
Actually, I was at Ken Levine did a talk at the BAFTAs a week ago now, 2 weeks ago, and I went to it, and there was a great moment, apologize if you're listening to this question asking man in this situation, the Q&A with Ken Levine, from questions from the audience, but it was funny. A guy said, you know, thank you for not cheapening your game with a multiplayer mode, because he thinks it reduces games or whatever. To which Ken Levine responded, well, you can really thank our inability to make a good one. And I that sounds like that was the reason that they played with it, and it just
didn't. Some news stories about a year ago about leaked ideas for multiplayer modes that they might have been playing with that didn't turn out that well, and they did sound really weird.
It's that's interesting, because there is a system called gear in it where you equip different trousers and shirts and hats, and they all sound very unlockable. They all sound like things you would unlock in a multiplayer game, and you would sort of have different classes by choosing these things. And the arenas that you fight in are all very... you have like fights in normal buildings and just going through corridors and stuff, and then there's these big centerpiece fights that all of them could easily be on a multiplayer map. They feel like you could just pull that out and make that multiplayer map. And so I expect that's probably how it used to work. It would, each person picks their different set of gear and they can unlock stuff as they level up and whatever. And then you play on these maps from the single player game that are very well designed combat arenas with things moving around them. So it doesn't totally surprise me to learn that they tried to do it. It'd be interesting to know why it didn't work. But yeah, I'm really glad it's not in there, because it does. I just find it really sad.
BioShock 2, for example, had quite a sad multiplayer mode bolted onto it.
Yeah, and people say it's quite fun. But
I did enjoy it, actually. But
there was an achievement for beating people to death with a golf club that was at some... I can't remember if it's like the Would You Kindly achievement or something like...
I think you might be getting confused with something else in that game, potentially.
There was definitely an achievement in the multiplayer mode. I think it might have been an event where everyone had golf clubs and you're just battering each other to death. And like, to take a really powerful moment from the single player story and do that with it.
In BioShock 2, there's a single player achievement that does the same thing. Where in BioShock 1, minor spoilers by the way, if you take a photo of Sander Cohen, you get the irony achievement.
Because he
gets you to take photos of like other corpses and things. If you take a photo of him, you get this achievement called irony. In the single player campaign, at some point, there's like a bust of Andrew Ryan, and if you use telekinesis to blast it with a golf club that you've picked up telekinesis, you get an achievement that's called Nine Irony, which, to be honest, is an amazing pun.
Good one. That's acceptable as long as the pun is good.
Good work. Good work. Whoever did that, but yeah.
Maybe it's not an achievement in multiplayer. Maybe it's the name of the game mode is like Would You Kindly or something.
Yeah, Jesus. Do multiplayer games intentionally? I mean, we've had plenty of good games that have had bolted on multiplayer modes that no one plays, that have remained good games regardless of whatever resources were invested in making multiplayer mode. Likewise, games like Mass Effect 3 that got multiplayer modes that no one thought they needed that turned out to be great. So I don't know if it's a clear-cut thing, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting because Mass Effect 3 was very careful about how it partitioned off the multiplayer mode and tried to make it a way, part of the fiction in a way that the BioShock 2 one just did not care about, really.
Actually, that's an amazing thing that I haven't heard someone talking about Citadel yet. This doesn't spoil anything, but in Citadel, when you unlock the kind of new hub area in the Citadel, like anywhere else in a BioWare game, you can walk past and hear people chatting and
Conversations.
All of the conversations in Citadel are between multiplayer characters, like off-duty multiplayer characters. Yeah. So you can walk past this one guy, like Asari, who's saying like, oh man, I just went on this mission with this really annoying Drell. Like, and the Drell of the characters, who their dodge move is this little backflip, and people do use it to kind of do this little celebratory backflip. It's like, we got to the end of the mission and he just wouldn't stop backflipping. I just don't understand why. And like, and there's this conversation between like a human and a Vorture saying like, seriously, the last mission I was on, like my own squad were on, like we were still recovering, so I had to meet up with just anyone who was available, and I'm never doing that again. Like, yes, they do just stand on top of ramps and shoot down. It was awesome. Like, it's really nicely sort of self-aware.
Yeah. I think if you're going to have such a strong story experience thing with a single player, you've got to kind of be a bit careful with it.
I wish they hadn't tied it into single player, like made your ending in single player dependent on your multiplayer performance.
It isn't, but, Like,
but you kind of feel like it is because
you feel like it is. Yeah, it's
a multiplier, isn't it?
It's a multiplier, but you don't need it. Like,
yeah, but it still affects what ending you
need. It kind of like if you got you start off like you can't go below 50%, right? If you play all three games thoroughly, you'll be so far over the maximum threshold for the best possible ending by the time you finish.
I wasn't at all. I was really near it. Yeah, like, I couldn't play multiplayer because I was reviewing it.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
And so I was the only quests I had left doing Mass Effect 3 were just the grindy ones where you just go to a planet and fetch it.
Oh no, it's not. Maybe to explain it differently. Okay, so you got that bar which can fill up, right?
Yeah.
You don't need to fill it to get the best ending. The best ending point is actually substantially.
Yeah,
before.
But I got like a really bad ending.
Oh really? Huh. That's interesting. Because, like, I'm now at the point where
it wasn't very completionist with Mass Effect 1 or 2 that I was, okay, like, some missions aren't not
that might
those.
Be it. But like even with 50, like even with like my rating at 50%, my like war assets are like twice what I would need.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like it's actually impossible for me to get a low enough. Like anyway, I think it's probably going to be the experience for a lot of people. But you're probably right actually. Maybe you do have to play it a little bit.
Also, if you're constantly flagging the fact that, hey, this is contributing to your single player, then you kind of assume it's important.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right from an experiential point of view. Like, definitely does influence the way people approach it.
Hmm.
Ben Borthwick, sort of super forum moderator, asks, aside from sensible options and killing Tom, what are your best methods for avoiding Bioshock Infinite spoilers? Tom can't avoid Bioshock Infinite spoilers because
he's immune now.
Read my review because it doesn't have any.
Yeah, true.
And
otherwise, stay off the internet. Apart from that one review, read that, close it all down, chill it.
I'm really surprised. I haven't read any other Bioshock Infinite reviews yet, but every time a big game comes out, I'm always surprised how much of the plot of the review spoil.
Yeah.
And you can't sort of, like, there's no place for me to put a spoiler warning on other people's reviews. So I'll do it now. Don't read other people's reviews. Only you ever read mine.
I haven't read anyone else's reviews. I've seen what the general scores are and stuff.
The ones I'm talking about don't start with a reassurance that there's no spoilers. Hmm. So I think reviews that do start with a reassurance that there's no spoilers are probably safe.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think it goes without saying, but like, be careful about Twitter and Reddit and everything else because there are jerks are everywhere. And
it's going to be, it's an especially hard game not to spoil in terms of like the things you want to say when other people are discussing it before you play it because they keep suggesting little things and you're always like, oh, that. And there's so many like funny coincidences with things that happen and things that we've said in the past that are amusing, but you can't say anything about them without spoiling something.
Then don't. I'm going to get close to Tom, his other option, which is killing you.
But once people have played it all the way through, I think spoilers are going to leak out because there's, particularly in screenshots and stuff, there are things you could screenshot that would just like ruin certain scenes.
Hmm. There is a reason I'm taking tomorrow off.
We've got a 4-day weekend this weekend.
Yeah, and a 4-day weekend. It's going to be great. Jerry Martin asks, is there a major difference between the gaming scene in the UK and Europe and the US? I think it's an interesting question, and possibly a bigger one than we have time to answer now.
Yeah, I'm sure we're qualified, or I'm qualified anyway, because having never been to the US.
I mean, I remember, like, the first time I went, I've spent a lot of time in the US, and, like, I remember the first time I went over there, I was hanging out in like college dorms and things, and I remember there being a much more open attitude to gaming in like universities and stuff than I'd ever seen in the UK. And it might have just been because of like my own experience and like, you know, who I hung out with and stuff. But like,
how do you mean?
Like people, like every dorm room every dorm room I went into, people had Guitar Hero setups and Rock Band and played Halo and like, you know, it was console gaming necessarily, but like it was really, really widespread in a way that I'd never experienced in the UK. And again, this might just be me that like,
okay.
I certainly grew up as like the only person I knew who played games really for most of it. I always assumed it was much more common and for a certain kind of bracket, more taboo here in terms of like being labeled a nerd and ostracized at school and stuff. But
there's certainly like interesting genre differences in different countries, like just within Europe. I was talking to the guys who make Divinity, and they were bemoaning the fact that the UK just doesn't seem to like their games nearly as much as Germany and a lot of other European countries do. And there's a certain kind of like, I haven't played those games, so I don't know anything about them, but I think there's a certain kind of story that goes down really well in other countries in Europe that doesn't go down well in the UK, that sort of quite traditional and complicated, and it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'd argue that in some ways, actually, the UK and the US are more similar than, for example, the UK and the US and, like,
Russia.
Eastern Europe in terms of game design. Or, like, what's popular in terms of simulators and stuff. Like,
yeah.
You can say, obviously, like, you know, because they're sort of equivalent markets, like, there's going to be a whole load of American gamers who the only game they really play is Madden and, you know, Halo when it comes out. And there's a direct equivalent for that in the UK and people who only play FIFA, right? Like,
there's a linguistic difference, which I always wonder if it reflects a difference in attitude as well, which is that I very often hear my American friends talk about beating a game, like, oh, I've got to beat that game, and I've beaten it, I'm done with it, whereas I always say completed, and that's what I usually hear people in England say. Just from the words, it sounds like Americans see it as a challenge and you've got to overcome the challenge, and once you overcome the challenge you win, and complete sounds like you're exploring it and you want to see all the stuff it's got to offer and then you're done with it. But I don't know if that's just purely a word thing.
I don't know. It is a big... I mean, it's an interesting question. And again, maybe it reflects on the previous esports thing, which is probably one of those regions where you start to really see big differences in sort of take-up for things like Barcraft and stuff. But at the same time, it is sort of happening everywhere at once.
Yeah. Really interesting question.
Yeah. It'd be worth exploring in more detail than we have time for
There's
now.
There's a good little detail in a Gamer Sutra report on the popularity of realistic simulator games, like sort of... job simulator games, you know, like Farming Simulator Euro Truck Driver and stuff. And the company that makes a lot of these was saying that they're like, the journalist was asking them, why do you think they're much more popular in Europe than they are in England? And he said, well, in the further east you go in Europe, the sort of more highly regarded the job of truck driver is, in that it's a relatively better paying and is seen as less a kind of menial thing and more like a sort of adventure thing. Like you're a man who goes off on adventures in a giant vehicle. It's really cool.
That is cool.
And so lots of people would like just want to be truck drivers. I think it's a really cool thing to do.
Cool.
Yeah, I would love to see a proper investigation into that though. It's a good question.
Frankly. Yeah.
To finish off, Dan Price asks, what game would you have taught in schools as part of an awesome new curriculum? I think it's a cool question. Like if you had a game course, or I don't know, it depends on the context really.
Teach how to play or teach how to make?
Well, it'd be like the game that I would have as an educational tool is one that already is. It'd be Minecraft or something where you can teach logic, you can teach creativity and things like that.
That's pretty good.
If I wanted to teach sort of like game concepts 101, I'd probably put the original BioShock in as a kind of quick shorthand for a bunch of different ideas that have kind of become part of games subsequently, like questioning the actions of the player and sort of basic morality systems and things. I don't think it's a definitive example of them, but I think it's one of the games that includes all of them.
Yeah, I can't do better than Minecraft.
Yeah, Minecraft's really good.
I guess if it was a course in kind of how to make games, then I think Deus Ex is always going to be an interesting thing to dissect. And it's the game I can talk about forever.
Yeah.
Which is a useful skill as a teacher.
In terms of like the history of games though, like if you're going to talk about like how to explain what the medium is and how it's changed, I don't know whether that would be like a parade of classics or whether you would dissect something like Deus Ex and look at all of its different lineages. That might be interesting. Like System Shock 2 might be an interesting one, where you take like the shooter genre and RPGs and old CRPG role-playing games and things and see how it all comes together. Actually, I might go with System Shock 2.
I don't know. It feels like you can't do it with one single game because that goes 4X games and RTS games, and that's a completely different school of design and different way of thinking about design.
Chess.
Yeah, chess. I'd rather talk about Go.
I think if you're going to talk about strategies, I think StarCraft 2 has just... there is an infinite amount to talk about.
Yeah.
Like, even as someone who, like, I don't play it competitively, but I'm fascinated by the differences in strategy and how the meta game changes even when the game itself hasn't. Like, without the game being patched, different strategies will come into prominence and fade away. And, like, it'll actually be, like, right now, the 2-gate rush at 4 minutes is more effective. It's better than it used to be because, in general, people don't do the thing that it's bad against.
That's really interesting.
That'd be interesting from sort of like a sociology point of view or something, just looking at how ideas change and trade between people and communities and things. That'd be interesting.
Sometimes in a recent game, I heard one of the casters thank the player for pulling off a strategy that seemed really unwise, but worked out because he plays the race that he was fighting against, and now he knows that everyone's going to be trying to do this amazing gambit that this guy pulled off, and no one's going to pull it off. So for a while, his game's going to be much easier because everyone's trying to do this.
That totally happens. You see it in Dota all the time as well. Actually, like some team will do something really pro, and like it's genuinely a condition. Like, oh god, this guy's playing like he's just watched a video. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? He's like, don't worry, guys, I'm going to do something amazing. And it just doesn't work. Yeah, people fall flat on their faces all the time.
It's like kids trying to do bicycle kicks after watching.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, really.
Like, you need like little disclaimers, like, you know, don't try and be Tony Hawk.
Yeah,
just like, you'll break your neck, and you know, don't try and be Dendy. You'll look like a dickhead.
Just be
like,
just be John Terry. Just stand in the box and be a rock. That's it. Or just play basic. Just don't try and do anything stupid.
Yeah. It's also amazing for a game that's played as much as it is that sometimes in an actual tournament, you'll see a pro-level player do something that no one's ever done before. They're like, use a strategy with a unit that just people didn't know it could be done. No one's ever tried it. And, you know, if they had tried it, they'd be dominating on the ladders because it's a strategy that works in the situation. The fact that like people are discovering things.
Yeah, those are the most exciting moments, I think. We've gotten way beyond teaching games in schools now and into why games are awesome. But it's kind of linked. And a good note to end on.
Yeah.
This has been a bumper longish episode of the PC Gamer Podcast. I have been Chris Thurston. You've been Tom Francis.
I have.
You've been Tom Senior. Yes. Bye.
Bye. Bye.